Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
But I'm up at 4 because I still go to the gym, still go to the gym, still go to the gym.
A study for the World Health Organization has warned that nearly 1.5 billion people could die early because they don't do enough exercise. The research, using data from nearly 2 million participants around the world, says Saudi Arabia and Iraq are among the worst countries for inactivity, with more than half of adults doing too little exercise. Health experts say we should do 75 minutes of vigorous activity a week. Those who don't face a higher risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes and some cancers. A health-conscious Ben Bland decided to hear more from our reporter Riley Carlson as they tried to exercise.
We've all heard the warnings, haven't we? We need to get up, we need to get moving, and we're not doing enough physical activity. And now a new report from the World Health Organization says that all around the world, we are not heeding those warnings. In the first study to estimate global physical activity trends over time, the World Health Organization says we all need to do better. So with that in mind, the newsroom's Riley Carlson is with me, going up a few flights of stairs, doing our bit. Riley, who's at risk then?
Well, not just you and me here, Ben. 1.4 billion adults are at risk of disease around the world from not getting enough exercise. So we need 150 moderate minutes a week, like walking up these stairs. If we're going to run up these stairs, we could count it as intense exercise. Yeah, I'm not going to follow you.
Come
running.
On, catch up.
And we'd only have to do about 75 minutes a week. This is actually a massive self-reported sample size in this report. Almost 2 billion people around the world. So it tells us quite a bit. Probably one of the biggest takeaways is that women were less active than men everywhere except East and Southeast Asia. In many parts of the world, the Middle East, North Africa, and especially high-income Western countries, women were not getting enough activity by 10% less than men, so it's a big gap. The authors say there can be a number of reasons for this, among them safety issues. Also, what's available for people? Is it affordable? What are the cultural norms in certain countries? And of course, what a specific individual has on their plate. 1 in 3 women and 1 in 3 men are not getting enough activity, so it's not great for either gender, really.
And there is a huge difference, isn't there, between developed and developing countries as well?
There really is. Mozambique and Uganda actually had the least inactivity, with just 6% not reaching the target. High-income Western countries are seeing far higher numbers of inactivity. And Dr. Fiona Bull, one of the report authors from the WHO, says that actually may be the price of progress.
What it's telling us and giving us an indication of is that as countries increase in their urbanization, people moving from rural countries to the cities for jobs and homes, as we develop industrialized and changing nature of work, as we change transport from walking, cycling more often to driving or motorbikes, we're seeing all these changes play in and they're having a consequence. We're actually becoming less active in our lifestyles. And I think we can all relate to that as we look about at our daily lives and see that you don't need to be active in so many ways.
And Riley, just remind me, why are we doing this again?
Well, this is the thing. We all know the answer to this, but it doesn't seem to be impacting us enough. There's a greater risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, dementia, and some cancers when you don't get enough physical activity. But look on the bright side here, Ben. You only have another 147 minutes to go this week. So you're welcome.
Riley Carson.
That's impossible. We are the ones. That's impossible. shake your tail, pass them around. 96 miles of beer on the wall. 96 miles of beer on the wall. 96 miles of beer. Take them now, pass them around. 95 miles of beer on the wall.
Finally, college fraternities in the US are known for their hard-drinking, hard-partying members. The societies for men are seen by many as highly prestigious. But in a huge shake-up of the rules, strong alcohol, such as vodka, whiskey and tequila, is being banned from frat houses. Charlotte Gallagher has the story.
Well, well, well. Looks like somebody forgot there's a rule against alcoholic beverages. In fraternities on probation.
Cool.
I didn't get that. Son.
A scene from the 1970s comedy Animal House, just one of the films about the US tradition of fraternities and sororities. But in recent years, fraternities in particular have been under intense scrutiny because of the behaviour of their members, who are usually from the most privileged sections of society. They've been linked to sexual assaults and been blamed for the deaths of young men in alcohol-fuelled hazing ceremonies. It's believed 70 people have died in the initiation drinking game since 2000. At Penn State University last year, 19-year-old Timothy Piazza fell to his death after drinking 18 drinks in 82 minutes. It was 12 hours before his fraternity brothers called for an ambulance. Hank Neuer is a journalism professor and has written a book about hazing.
There's this conception that you have to earn your membership, number one. Number two, it's gone on so long that the people who have been hazed want to administer hazing to others. And like in anything else, there's always one-upsmanship. So it often gets worse the following year after an initiation.
Now the organisation, which represents the majority of fraternities, has voted to ban strong alcohol from all frat houses. Even members over 21 will not be exempt. Beer and wine will still be allowed under the new rules, which fraternities have been told they must enforce by September next year.
Charlotte Gallagher.
I myself made long ago when I voted against a federal holiday in memory of Dr. King. I was wrong. I was wrong.
We all make mistakes. We all make mistakes.
I was wrong and eventually realized that in time to give full support for a state holiday in my home state of Arizona.
That was, of course, John McCain standing outside the Lorraine Motel in the rain, barely visible because of the umbrellas, apologizing. Some would say belatedly, but apologizing for having in 1983 in the United States Congress, as a freshman member of Congress, voted against the designation of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday as a national holiday.
It was a day devoted to the memory of United States Senator John McCain, a Republican nominee for president, a prisoner of war, a decorated Navy pilot, and the son and grandson of Navy admirals. America's political leadership, with the exception of the current president, gathered with the McCain family to honor the man and his service to country. The casket bearing Senator McCain's body was carried from the Capitol this morning after lying in state there yesterday. The procession to Washington, D.C.'s National Cathedral included a stop at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, where the senator's widow, Cindy McCain, placed a wreath honoring her husband and his fellow veterans. More than 2,000 politicians, family, friends, and members of the military attended the invitation-only service. President Donald Trump was not invited and was seen leaving the White House, presumably headed for his Virginia golf course during the funeral service. The 2.5-hour service was filled with music. Prayers.
We commend your servant John.
And personal remembrances.
My father is gone. John Sidney McCain III was many things.
His daughter Meghan McCain kept with the senator's reputation as a political maverick who was not afraid to criticize members of his own Republican Party.
We gather here to mourn the passing of American greatness. The real thing. Not cheap rhetoric from men who will never come near the sacrifice he gave so willingly. The America of John McCain has no need to be made great again because America was always great.
Before his death last weekend from brain cancer, John McCain planned much of today's ceremony, inviting former Presidents Bush and Obama to speak.
Perhaps above all, John detested the abuse of power, could not abide bigots and swaggering despots.
We never doubted the other man's sincerity or the other man's patriotism, or that when all was said and done, we were on the same team. So much of our politics, our public life, our public discourse can seem small and mean and petty. Trafficking in bombast and insult and phony controversies and manufactured outrage. It's a politics that pretends to be brave and tough, but in fact is born of fear. John called on us to be bigger than that. He called on us to be better than that.
Senator McCain will be laid to rest tomorrow at the United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Maybe we'll never see a black man in the White House again. I write a check to the IRS, my pockets get slim. Damn, do I even have a say about where it's going? Some older nigga told me to start voting. I said democracy is too fucking slow.
Congressman Michael Capuano, a Democrat from Massachusetts, has been in office for nearly two decades. He's pretty popular at home, and yet he could not win his primary race yesterday. Ayanna Pressley beat him. It was yet another upset by an outsider candidate. With no Republican running this fall, she is set to become the first black woman representing a district from New England in Congress. Pressley said last night, "It seems like change is on the way." NPR's Asma Khalid has been following this story, and she's with us in our studios in Washington. Hi, Asma.
Hey, David.
So you both cover politics for us, and you live in the Boston area, so you know a lot about this. What do you make of this outcome? Was it surprising?
It definitely was surprising, David. And I say that for two major reasons. One is that Mike Capuano had a lot of institutional support. You know, there was the Democratic Party operation that was supporting him. But also, he knew that Ayanna Pressley was going to be a formidable challenger. So he had gone out and gotten the support of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC and the support of Deval Patrick, who's the state's first African-American governor. So, I mean, that was part of it, right, that he had a lot of this support. But the second thing is he also just had a lot of money. And you look at polling and you know, I did not see a single poll that had given Ayanna Pressley the lead. And if you look at the final results, she came out victorious by about 18 percentage points.
Wow. I mean, the polls just weren't predicting that in any way. How did she do it?
You know, part of what her campaign has spoken about is that she had a lot of institutional grassroots support, you know, which is really different than the party institutional support. She was knocking on doors and out in neighborhoods. And the other thing is, David, she's a really phenomenal campaigner. I have covered a lot of candidates, and early on I told my editor that she was just a really sort of charismatic speaker and able to energize a lot of people.
What does – I mean, I know she brought up the idea of representation in the party and in politics. So what kind of role did that play as she was trying to get voters to be with her?
Yeah, she's spoken a lot about this. This is the only majority-minority district in the state of Massachusetts, and Ayanna Pressley had made the argument that it's not just about Democrats winning. It's about who those Democrats are. And, David, to me, what was really interesting is this is yet another sign of sort of the strength that we've seen of African-American female candidates. You know, we saw Stacey Abrams, who's the Democratic nominee in the state of Georgia. We've seen Jahana Hayes, who won her district in Connecticut, Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. I mean, the list sort of goes on and on. And you've seen these African-American women who've been really successful, not just in majority districts of people of color.
So what is all this telling us about the Democratic Party going forward?
That, I think, is a really good question.
Right.
And I think that maybe what we learned last night is a little bit better of a signal than what we saw, you know, with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez victory in New York. And part of that is because Ayanna Pressley grew up in Democratic Party institutions. She wasn't really a party outsider. And maybe one of the things I think we are learning is that there are, you know, districts like this Massachusetts 7th where people are trying to reassemble the Obama coalition and prove that you can have African-American voters as well as white, liberal, highly educated voters and reassemble them together. And it seems like Ayanna Pressley was able to do that.
Okay. Surprise. Fascinating night in the state of Massachusetts last night. NPR's Asma Khalid telling us about it. Thanks so much, Asma, as always.
You're welcome. Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
now, a word from the president.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
With the NFL season about to begin, President Trump is already tweeting complaints about player protests during the national anthem. His focus on the NFL protests and his tweets about several prominent African Americans this summer has renewed attention on the way Trump interacts with the black community. NPR's Ayesha Roscoe reports.
Back in June, President Trump scrapped the White House celebration for the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles.
And we always will stand for the national anthem.
He blamed the NFL protests, which had been mostly carried out by black players. That wasn't the only time this summer Trump got into disputes with notable African Americans. His summer was marked by tweeted insults about black Americans who criticize him and praise for black celebrities who back him. NPR looked at Trump's tweets from June until Labor Day. He tweeted about 900 times. Nearly 50 tweets were focused on a black person or black people in general. Of those, 20 were negative in tone. A top target was California Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a black woman.
Maxine Waters is leading the charge. Maxine. She's a real beauty. Maxine. A seriously low IQ person.
That was Trump at an August campaign rally. On Twitter, Trump continued to challenge her intellect. He also questioned the intelligence of former White House aide Omarosa Manigault Newman, NBA superstar LeBron James, and CNN anchor Don Lemon. He even called Manigault Newman a dog. Ian Haney Lopez of UC Berkeley wrote a book about racial dog whistles in politics. He says Trump's words can't be disconnected from this country's long history of racist stereotypes and discrimination.
When he takes on African Americans as public figures and he begins to use words like dog or dumb or lowlife, these are words that, when applied to African Americans, carry a very heavy racial charge.
One example of charged language was a July tweet about the Democratic nominee for governor in Georgia, who Trump tweeted was, quote, crime-loving. Trump didn't refer to her by name, but that nominee, Stacey Abrams, is black. Typically, Trump calls Democrats weak on crime, so why the different language about Abrams? A White House official says it wasn't aimed at her, but at Democrats as a whole. Haney Lopez, though, says Trump shouldn't get the benefit of the doubt. After all, he started his political career pushing false allegations that former President Obama wasn't born in the U.S.
Dog whistling, by its definition, involves both pushing race into the public conversation and denying that you're doing any such thing.
White House spokesman Hogan Gidley says Trump's insults are not about race, that Trump is a, quote, counterpuncher who defends himself when attacked. Trump's tweets this summer do include name-calling for black and white people that have aggrieved him. Mark Burns is a black pastor who has advised the president. He says he doesn't agree with everything Trump says, but
privately, I've seen a man who really treats everybody the same, regardless of color. And that's the God honest truth.
Trump does seem to relish highlighting any black celebrity who voices support for him, like Tiger Woods, Jim Brown, and Kanye West.
Kanye West gets it. He gets it. He gets it. And he saw that. When he sees that African American unemployment is the lowest in history, you know, people are watching.
Low black unemployment is something Trump mentions constantly, like he did at that Michigan rally. The White House says it's those economic policies, not his language, that should matter. But Clarence Lussain of Howard University says Trump's talk of low black unemployment is just a way to shield himself from accusations of racism.
The target is really white voters who are going to be uncomfortable with thinking that they're voting for an overtly racist president.
Going into Labor Day, a new poll showed Trump's approval rating with African Americans at just 3%. 2 days later, Trump tweeted about black celebrities who he considers allies and again highlighted low black unemployment. Ayesha Roscoe, NPR News, Washington.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired! Oh.
for the land, hand of the free.
Overnight, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick refusing to stand during the national anthem again. This time, he took a knee right behind hundreds of service members being honored on Military Appreciation Night.
And he's receiving heavy boos here.
The crowd booing every time he took a snap.
Colin Kaepernick may not have played in the National Football League since 2016, but he's front and center once again as the NFL starts its new season tomorrow. This week, he became the face of Nike's 30th anniversary Just Do It ad campaign. It's a controversial choice. He took a knee to protest police brutality against African Americans. He inspired others to join him, but his stance appeared to cost him dearly. And now he's suing the NFL, alleging team owners colluded to keep him unsigned to any team. The combination of this controversial quarterback with the world's largest sports, footwear, and apparel company has been combustible, sometimes literally.
Sorry, Nike. I've been buying you for the past 20-plus years. Not anymore. Not only am I burning my favorite pair of Nikes, you are burning your sales. Have a good day.
Five pairs of shoes in there, all gonna let them burn. Because Nike decided to make Colin Kaepernick their ambassador when he doesn't share the same opinions as the people.
There's been plenty of support online for the Nike deal, too.
I think Nike did an amazing job, and I think they did the right move by signing Kaepernick. Whether it's a money grab for them or not, because they know there is a big, big fan base that would support them for signing Nike, to me, that's not the issue.
His story is starting to become a narrative where you're seeing heroism. You're starting to see him as a hero. In the same realm that people did Muhammad Ali back in the day. Because remember, Muhammad Ali was like, I ain't going to no Vietnam. And so now, that narrative is changing for Colin Kaepernick. It's making people uncomfortable because they were like, no, we thought we finished him off. What is he doing getting a Nike ad? Why is he the face of anything?
Positive or negative, the endorsement has garnered Nike a tremendous amount of free publicity, more than $40 million U.S. worth in just 24 hours, according to one estimate. But with Colin Kaepernick set to become a prominent face for the company for years to come, it suggests Nike has concluded a player's political protest could be a winner for its bottom line, or at least worth the risk. I'm joined by two guests who've been tracking the reaction to this deal. Morgan Campbell is a reporter with the Toronto Star who writes about the intersection of sports and business. He's with me in our Toronto studio. And Charles Robinson is a senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. He's in Houston, Texas. Hello, gentlemen. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
I have to ask you, Nike has this big ad campaign with Kaepernick. It also, and Charles, you've written about this, it also has the contract for most of the NFL franchise uniforms. Are we being played here?
Well, it's definitely strange bedfellows. You know, they've extended that contract actually out to 2028. So it's a 10-year deal. But at the end of the day, Nike and the NFL both know that this is about the bottom line. And I think the NFL put out a statement yesterday essentially saying that a whole lot of nothing, that, you know, the issues that are being raised by Colin Kaepernick are important and they should be recognized. I think both sides here, at least in this business deal, know that the bottom line is lucrative for each of them and that makes no sense for either to attack each other on this landscape, even though it's clearly awkward that Nike has signed Colin Kaepernick. And I'm not entirely sure that they gave the NFL the heads up. It looked like the NFL was a little bit on its heels with its statement.
Morgan, what are you thinking as you watch all this?
Well, as far as the NFL and the Nike deal and Colin Kaepernick are concerned, we also have to remember that the NFL, no one at the NFL or the owners of any of these various teams are in a position to criticize this deal in public, because their official public position, especially as this lawsuit is concerned, is that there's nothing wrong with Colin Kaepernick as a guy. The whole reason he's not in the NFL is simply because he's not good enough. This is what they're saying. So now if they come out and say this is a bad deal because Colin Kaepernick is controversial, then that lends credence to Colin Kaepernick's argument that the reason he's not in the NFL is because of his politics, not because of his ability to play the game. So from Kaepernick's perspective, all of these, whatever critics he might have in the NFL or among NFL owners, have been kind of checkmated and muzzled by this move because they can't say anything bad about it in public because that helps him.
Other people can. However, I want to play a clip for you which sums up a lot of the criticism of the deal. This is former Republican Governor Mike Huckabee speaking on Fox Business Network yesterday.
So why are they somehow elevating him to some hero status? I mean, they used to have guys like Michael Jordan and the top athletes in their field, and now they got a guy who nobody wants to have him on their team. And he's primarily known for his protests and wearing socks with policemen depicted as pigs. I'm wondering if Nike's going to sell those socks as part of their new deal with him. And it's also a way to wave their middle finger at half the American voters and half the American public who are leaving the NFL in droves, not only in television ratings, but in the purchase of merchandise and tickets. And there are a lot of empty seats in NFL games right now because people are just fed up.
Okay, so that is former Republican Governor Mike Huckabee, father of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who speaks for Donald Trump. Charles Robinson, what do you think of what he's saying? Does this ad campaign risk further alienating NFL fans?
It's not even factual. I mean, I'm just going to be honest here. Like, it's what he's saying. The NFL's own private research data does not back up what he said. So about a year ago, the NFL commissioned a study through GPG, which is a Washington-based consultants firm. And they asked fans, what do you think Colin Kaepernick should have a job in the NFL? And what they got in terms of data when it came back was overwhelmingly minorities and liberals supported Kaepernick. And I think, you know, somewhat what we expected, the aging demographic and in particularly white males did not. Now, what was really interesting was when you looked at the data in terms of age demographics, by far millennials, I think it was almost a 3-to-1 margin, supported Colin Kaepernick. And for both the NFL and also Nike, guess what demographic they're seeking out for the next wave? The NFL and Nike are both seeking out millennials. They're seeking out minorities. They're seeking out a larger, broader base than, frankly, the aging white male that currently exists as a primary, you know, ticket buyer, primary merchandise buyer. I heard the clip when we came in. You had someone saying, well, geez, I've bought Nikes for 20 years and now I'm going to burn them. Well, guess what? Nike is not concerned about the 40-year and over crowd, the 50-year and over crowd. They're aiming for the younger demographic, the same demographic they were aiming for when they put Michael Jordan and Spike Lee in a very, very forward Mars Blackman themed campaign, the Charles Barkley I Am Not a Role Model campaign, which was highly unpopular. This is not new ground for Nike, and I think this is something that politicians fail to understand. They're very good at this.
Morgan, what do you think?
One thing we're not going to do is get me to engage Mike Huckabee and take him seriously on anything. We're not doing that this morning. But what I will say is this, further to Charles's point, like the guy that's been the cranky old white guy, conservative, probably racist or at least racist adjacent white guy who's burning his Nikes and he's been buying them for 20 years, allegedly. He's aging out of Nike's demographic. He's about to start buying, you know, Rockports anyway, and New Balance mall walkers, right? So it really doesn't matter. And the thing about
those are fighting words. Keep going.
Although New Balance, we need a whole walkers. Other segment on New Balance, but Nike. And here's what people miss, and this is the calculation Nike made, which is the exact opposite of the calculation that ESPN made with Jemele Hill when Jemele Hill called Donald Trump a white supremacist, which is the only thing you can call a guy that defends white supremacists. But ESPN said, well, we will listen to this small but really loud group of conservatives who may or may not even be our customers, but we will buckle to them anyway and discipline Jemele Hill over this. And what Nike has said is the opposite. Like, we're okay, you guys can make noise, burn your shoes online. Cool. You guys already paid for the shoes, by the way. So we got your money. And the other thing is, the NFL and Nike are not selling the same thing, right? The NFL is selling, you know, violence wrapped in pageantry and performative patriotism and show business and all this. Nike is selling performance, but Nike is also selling cool. So you can try to align yourself with Donald Trump, do things that will make him happy, do things that will please his constituents. But for all those things those guys are, the thing they are not is cool. So it really doesn't matter if you do something that that riles them up because they're not cool. They're not the people you're looking to sell to anyway.
There's another aspect to this. Nike also faces blowback from some of its longtime critics. This is Madeline Ochabilo. She's a member of the United Students Against Sweatshops, and they campaign for workers' rights, and they've specifically campaigned against Nike.
This ad shows to us that Nike is trying to pick and choose what side of justice they're choosing to stand on. So from our point of view, it's like if Nike wants to support racial justice in the U.S., like they're doing with this ad, they have to support racial justice abroad too, which includes their workers that work in factories in Indonesia and other countries. And if they're choosing to produce their apparel under sweatshop conditions, then it's obvious that they're not being consistent.
What do you guys think of that? Charles?
I think that's absolutely fair criticism. It's awkward. It's always been awkward territory for Nike when it's come to taking a moral or social stance in the world, because the backdrop, the silhouette behind Nike has always been overseas conditions in factories. And it's no different than when Apple takes a stand, or any multinational, many multinational corporations that choose to wade waist deep into socially conscious behavior. The first question is, well, where are you when you have far below minimum wage workers overseas, when factory conditions are poor? Nike's had to deal with that, and Apple's the same. It's an awkward space that Nike has to coexist in. It's similar to other corporations, and I think people who want to criticize them for that are absolutely right to do so.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
In the United States, we pride ourselves on being a country that respects the rule of law. But of course, our listeners know that those in charge of enforcing the law do not always respect the limitations of their power. Over the last 10 years, the killings of more than a dozen unarmed black men and women at the hands of police officers have led to the rise of Black Lives Matter and similar movements, which have been calling out abuses and misconduct perpetrated by police officers. But while the murder of an unarmed person generates a lot of media attention, and rightly so, there are other, quieter abuses happening all across the country. In our next segment, we're going to travel to southeast Louisiana to a town called Ville Platte, where reporter Ian McDougall has been documenting the alarming practices of the local police. Ian is a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica, and we welcome him now to WNYC. Ian, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So this investigation begins in, am I pronouncing the town right, Ville Platte?
That's correct.
Okay. Where is this town? And tell us, paint a picture of what it's like there.
Sure. Ville Platte is sort of in the south central part of the state. It's sort of north of the sort of marshy cane fields down closer to the Gulf people think of. It looks kind of like Iowa if you put palmettos and crawfish ponds. They're sort of this flat plain. It's a Cajun country, so it's very still people who speak French there, all kinds of French food, boudin, and so on. The town itself is quite small. It's only about 7,000 people.
That's small.
It's very small, yeah. And it's there used to be the state highway that connected Lafayette up to Alexandria, and Shreveport ran right through town, becomes Main Street. It used to bring commerce through the interstate in the 80s, bypassed that state highway. So it's kind of – the town was never exactly prosperous, but it's become even poorer since then.
Dear. You start off in your story with an anecdote about a young boy, 12 years old, named Bobby Lewis. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Bobby and what happened to him?
Sure. Bobby, it was a sort of drizzly, chilly for Louisiana December morning in 2016. Some friends of his were cutting school, so they
uh-oh.
<you know. laughs> but who didn't at some point?
Right.
And they had taken shelter under a carport, an abandoned house. There are tons of abandoned houses all over Ville Platte. And a neighbor had seen one of them throw a rock through a window in this abandoned house. So fast forward a couple hours, a detective named Jessica Laborde, who goes by Scrappy.
Scrappy,
yeah, self-identifies as that. Has gotten this report and sees Bobby walking along the street near his house, picks him up, tells him to get in the back of the squad car, brings him into the station house.
I want to stop you. This is hours later.
A couple hours later.
So Scrappy is not seeing Bobby at the scene of the
alleged rock throw or anything like that. This is later and he's in another place.
That's correct. And the neighbor who had reported this didn't know which of the three boys had thrown it. Generally speaking, you need a police officer needs can't just arrest somebody. They need probable cause to take someone into custody. They don't have probable cause just because somebody was near the scene of a crime.
So why did Officer Scrappy pick up Bobby?
Well, she was following, I guess, in the footsteps of a long history of detaining people without probable cause there.
What's known as investigative holds? Are those they?
Yeah, this is sort of the inheritor of the practice, you could say. After the FBI and the Justice Department and others began investigating the sort of the older practice, which involved detaining people for days, sometimes weeks on end, what's happened, I found, is the police in Ville Platte have taken the practice underground and essentially taken sort of two more subtler ways of reaching the same end, I guess you'd say.
I don't mean to keep interrupting because I want you to paint the right picture with Bobby. So Officer Scrappy picks him up and takes him in. This is hours after the rock being thrown and hitting a window, which we've seen in any number of episodes of the Andy Griffith Show. Opie was always breaking windows, but okay, so he's hauled in. Then what happens?
So he's brought into the station house and taken into the Scrappy's office. Where without a parent or a lawyer present, she and another officer began, you know, giving him the third degree. But not just about the rock and the window. She starts asking about thefts and drug dealing and gun selling and accusing him and his friends of having been involved in this kind of activity. He says, "I don't know what you're talking about," but she's insisting. He told me that he, you know, write all of this down, confess and implicate his friends in these crimes, and then sign it again without a parent or a lawyer present.
He's a minor.
He is, yeah.
I mean, minors have rights, and there's also Miranda. I mean, where are these things that are? What's going on?
Right. No, I mean, none of that. He wasn't Mirandized until later when another officer called his mother and she showed up. And she told me that when she asked them to stop questioning him while she got a lawyer, they continued to ask him questions. You know, the truth is down there, it's, you know, the rule of law is sort of not the animating principle. It's kind of convenience for police officers. And I should say that I tried to reach Scrappy and she I couldn't get in touch with her. The police chief, though, denied that anything like that would have happened.
Interesting.
This is sort of a piece of the sort of broader ethic or culture of policing in this town and in towns like it all over the South.
So going back, these investigative holds, are they legal to do? I mean, what does the law say in terms of police and how they can arrest or jail someone and for how long? What's written law?
Right. So the essential principle is that police need probable cause, which is essentially a sort of a fair sense that the person is committing or has committed a crime.
Yeah.
They need that in order to arrest someone in the first place and to detain them. Once they've detained them, if they have a warrant from a judge or a magistrate already, they're okay. If they don't, they have to, within 48 hours, generally speaking, go before a judge and have that judge essentially approve the arrest, find that there was probable cause.
But those 48 hours, is the person in custody during that time?
They can be. I mean, the standard really is the police have to do it as quickly as they reasonably can. But sometimes there are reasons why they can't immediately go to a judge.
Ian, at one point you wrote that the Justice Department found more than two dozen instances in which juveniles were subjected to investigative holds. Is that normal?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the FBI agent who's mentioned in the Justice Department report, people who had talked to him told me that that was one of the things that was most staggering when he came across this practice initially, that there were children being detained this way. It was bad enough to detain anybody that way. But.
And your data shows that from 2012 to 2014, the police unlawfully held at least 700 people in Ville Platte, which is about a tenth of the town's residents.
That's right. And to be fair, that's the Justice Department statistics. I don't want to take credit
okay,
for it.
Okay, well, it's quoted in your article.
Yes, right,
it's not. This is not the Ian McDougall statistic. It's the Justice Department. So,
So
the Justice Department sees this is going on. Mm. So what happened when this data started coming in? This is under Eric Holder and the Obama administration when I guess these numbers flagged.
That's right. Yeah, that Justice Department, first under Tom Perez, who went on to become Labor Secretary and now head of the DNC, and then later Vinita Gupta, had been very focused on police reform. And
right.
So when they got this call from this FBI agent, as they describe in their report, they first of all recognized it as a problem that they'd had reports on from all over the South, Mississippi, Alabama, other parts of Louisiana. And they, as they went through court records, they found that this was a practice you could find still going on all over the country and in places. And so they thought, well, this is a place that has a really egregious version of this practice going on, and we have a chance to go in, document it, and then negotiate a consent decree, essentially a reform agreement overseen by a judge, and sort of not only fix this practice in this town, but show other police departments across the country and communities across the country how they can go about fixing similar practices there.
Can we back up and go back to that FBI agent? His sure. name was Steve Krueger, right? So how does he come into the story?
So he had been in Ville Platte. He was based down in Lafayette, about an hour or so south of Ville Platte. And he had been in Ville Platte investigating, helping the local police investigate a murder. And as the Justice Department describes in the report, and people who'd spoken to him told me, he found, to his surprise, that as he was going around, people were really reluctant to talk to him. And eventually, in talking to the police there, someone mentioned to him that they held people without any basis for up to 72 hours. It turns out sometimes it was quite a bit longer than
yes.
that.
Yes.
And when he heard that, people who talked to him said he was sort of just bowled over by it. And he said this is extremely illegal and told the chief that. And the chief, you know, perhaps not liking his authority to be challenged, sort of said, no, we've always done that. They did that before I started. He'd been there. The chief started in 1991 as a patrol officer. So they've been doing that since I started and before.
This is Neil Lartigue. He's the chief of police that you're talking
Neil
about.
Lartigue.
I'm seeing Lart. I wrote it down. Lartigue. Darn it out. He's the chief that says, oh, it started before me.
Right.
We're just keeping it going.
Yes. Yeah. And so there was a process of trying to find prosecutors locally who could criminally look at this. But ultimately, it ended up going to the Civil Rights Division in Washington that doesn't criminally prosecute. Well, they do have a section that does, but the folks that it went to handle these civil police reform matters. And so he was ultimately guided to them and gave them a call, and that's what started this.
So the DOJ comes in 2016, and they release this report, and it seems like the wheels of justice maybe are going to catch up to Ville Platte. And then what happens?
Well, so the report, which is quite scathing, that's where that 700 people.
Unbelievable.
Comes from. It really
a tenth
is.
Of a town locked
yeah.
up
yeah, at some period.
Point.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's
Why
not? Not surprising no one wanted to talk to law enforcement.
They're petrified.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So the plan at that point, this is December 2016, the report comes out, and the plan was to begin negotiating one of these consent decrees that would have the power of a federal judge behind it. So if the police aren't abiding by the agreement, the judge can, you know, can hold them in contempt and has other remedies.
Unfortunately, a lot changes in November of 2016.
So a lot changes in November, and not only the election of Donald Trump, but more importantly, the choice of Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama, as the attorney general. And he had long before this point voiced a great disagreement not only with police reforms under the Obama administration in general, but the use of consent decrees in particular, because he viewed them as, you know, infringing on state and local authority and also undermining the sort of work of police. And in fairness to him, there are a lot of fair critics of the Obama administration's use of consent decrees as being maybe a bit more aggressive than they ought to have been and things like that. But that wasn't really his concern or whether they worked or didn't work well enough. His concern was really a sort of first principles kind of issue. He just disagreed with them in general.
My goodness. I'm Nancy Giles. I'm speaking with ProPublica reporting fellow Ian McDougall about his recent article titled How the Trump Administration Went Easy on Small Town Police Abuses. I just have to say, so Jeff, and it's funny because Jeff Sessions is really under a lot of fire and criticism now from President Trump, but people forget that he's been a very effective, head of the DOJ. I mean, he's gotten a lot of his, he's rolled back a lot of legal protection. He's really done Trump's bidding very effectively. So what does Jeff Sessions jump in and do with this, with the information that he has from the 2016 report?
So initially, things are kind of rolling along as they would otherwise. It takes a little bit of time, but a couple attorneys, staff attorneys who've been working on this case go down in March of 2017 to have a community meeting and meet with local law enforcement to start the negotiation process. But at the very end of that month, Sessions issues a memo saying, we're going to start reviewing all of the consent decrees. We're going to start looking at this. People within the Justice Department will tell you that they saw the writing on the wall. It was just reviewing consent decrees, but they kind of knew what that meant.
Oh, yeah.
And almost immediately they tried to pull back a consent decree that was almost finalized in Baltimore. In April, Sessions wrote a op-ed that quite explicitly said, we're not going to do these as a sort of political expedient and handcuff police and the like.
All right. Just to underscore this, can we just identify and define what is a consent decree so we understand that?
So it's a negotiated agreement between the Justice Department and Police Department where the Police Department agrees to make certain changes. So that could be, you know, greater training, different policies, more carefully monitoring how police are doing their job. What makes it different from a normal agreement is that it's effectively a lawsuit. It ends up being sort of signed off on by a federal judge, that judge then oversees the process. So if the police department isn't doing what they're supposed to be doing, the Justice Department can come in and say, judge, you need to make them do that.
Okay, so we've talked about poverty and how that would influence the things that were or were not done. As a follow-up, what about race? It's a predominantly black town?
It is, yeah. It's about two-thirds black, a third white, which is about the inverse of the parish, which is what they call counties down there as a whole. Though this isn't really a story of sort of white police and black citizenry.
Why is that, Ian?
Well, it's in the sort of the, I guess, the 80s and 90s, the former white power structure essentially allowed black officials to start getting elected into office. And so the police chief, Neil Lateague, is black. The mayor, Jennifer Vedrine, is black. And there's a guy I talked to named Raymond Anderson, who himself is black down there. And he said, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he said, when I was growing up, there was only white cops, and we thought that was bad, but it didn't make any difference when the black cops came in. I think sort of the implication of what he was saying was that those kinds of power structures and the sort of interactions between race and power don't change just because the race of the people in power change.
This is important to note because, of course, because of my own biases, I immediately jump to, when you look at the stats, that most of the people that are thrown in jail are disproportionately of color. I assumed, well, this is, you know, because of the white power structure, and it is not.
No, I mean, the police force is I don't know the exact number, but I would guess about half white, half black.
We move into Mississippi, and you know how that spelled. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hump back I.
In late August, 33-year-old Nicole Rathman was just a week shy of being released from the Central Mississippi Correctional Facility. Nicole had served 6 years for a nonviolent drug conviction.
She wanted to get out and be with her grandmother, who she considered her best friend in Mississippi, and she has a 12-year-old son that she was just reconnecting with.
That's Nicole's mother, Rita Corson. Because of a Mississippi reform law that went into effect this summer, her daughter was eligible for parole. Nicole had been corresponding with state lawmakers to thank them and was hoping to become a counselor to help other people with substance abuse issues. But her release day never came. On August 23rd, 2018, Nicole was declared dead at a hospital in Jackson. State officials told her mother that she died of an aneurysm, probably related to meth use. Then a different story emerged.
A cellmate called her grandmother in Mississippi, and that's how we found out. She was beat in the head and had to get 4 staples, and then after that, she was beat with some padlocks that were put in a sock by a cellmate. Over $16. Within a few days of her dying, she was having such horrible headaches that she was literally trading her psych meds to people for ibuprofen.
Nicole was one of at least 16 inmates who died in Mississippi state prisons in the month of August in an unusual spike.
My daughter may have been a drug addict, but, you know, she was a good person. She was a human being, and this was an injustice from, you know, being put in there for as long as she was and the help that she didn't receive in there. You know, somebody needs to pay for this. And by that, I don't mean money. There has to be some change in this system. that's what this is all about for me, making sure the other Nicoles of the world are not treated inhumanely like this.
We reached out to the Mississippi Department of Corrections, and they declined to answer our questions about Nicole Rathman's death. They pointed us to an online statement which reads, "The Mississippi Department of Corrections takes seriously its constitutional mandate to provide health care to all individuals in its custody. All deaths are investigated. The department believes that a majority of the deaths are from natural causes, in that they include cancer, coronary, and other medical conditions." Michelle Liu is a reporter for Mississippi Today who covers criminal justice. She's been following the story.
So between 2012 and 2017, there were an average of 4.5 inmate deaths per month, no more than 11 in any given month, all of which is to say that 16 people dying in 1 month is certainly out of line of prior data, and that number merits further attention.
Now, do we know what could have led to these conditions if we're not talking only about natural causes? You know, could it have been too much heat? Was there not enough medical attention? Are there not enough medical facilities in these prisons? What could have led to this? Do we know?
I mean, experts have mentioned all of the above causes as conditions that we certainly can't rule out at this point in time, right? Both prison officials and local coroners maintain that the majority of these deaths are natural, but we don't have official causes because all in-custody deaths have to go through the state medical examiner's office, which has been chronically underfunded and understaffed by the state legislature. So there's only a handful of staff doing hundreds of autopsies each, and that accompanying paperwork really gets caught up in a backlog.
Now, we're talking specifically here about Nicole Rathman, and I'm wondering if there have been any updates on her story.
I haven't heard anything new about Nicole's story. When I spoke with the coroner who handled her case, along with a few other deaths from last month, he indicated that the majority of the cases his office had seen that month were of natural causes, but he could not comment on Nicole's because it was under investigation.
Michelle, I'm wondering, what are the conditions generally in the jails in Mississippi and the prisons?
Well, going back to our discussion about whether or not a death is natural, several experts and advocates maintain that focusing on causes of death is almost kind of a moot point in terms of whether deaths are natural or not. Rather, it's that inmates are having medical care delayed or denied until they die of a completely preventable natural cause. And that's a problem which is exacerbated by the fact that Mississippi prisons have long been short-staffed so that there's less attention being paid to inmates and their needs.
Are inmates, do they have a right to health care when they're incarcerated?
The answer is yes, right? The Department of Corrections in Mississippi has itself articulated that it has a constitutional mandate to provide health care to people in custody, and it takes that mandate seriously. And I think the public really wants to see proof of that now.
Mm. What about the advocacy side of this and inmates, families of inmates who are potentially concerned about their own loved ones? Is there any movement on the advocacy or family front here?
I think we'll have to wait and see as to in terms of how families take legal recourse, if they will. I've heard from many families of prisoners in the system, of those who died in August, who are really worried, who are looking for ways to get answers, whether if not directly from the prisons, from their lawmakers, from the governor. And I mean, I think we can also look backwards and forwards at this issue, right? We've had reported incidents in recent years of prisoners who are being neglected or ignored when they're calling for help, of prisoners who can and do file grievances and lawsuits against the state regarding medical issues. Just last year, about 24 prisoners in one of Mississippi's prisons went on a hunger strike to protest their conditions. And we can also look towards lawsuits that have been filed in the last decade and a half against the state's privately run prisons, one of which just went to trial this spring, where inmates even testified about setting fires to get guards' attention when they needed medical help.
So this appears to be a much more broad issue than I think we're assuming here with these specific deaths. This seems to be systemic across the state of Mississippi in terms of prison conditions.
Right. That's definitely what we're looking at.
Now, last week, the commissioner of the Corrections Department said she was communicating with the FBI about the recent uptick in deaths. And I'm just trying to understand where the federal government might be going with this.
Sure. I mean, they haven't expanded that far. The statement from the FBI basically says that on the last day of August, the commissioner reached out to them and they would be in touch to examine the facts, and that the FBI takes all allegations of civil rights violations seriously. They haven't expanded further. The key takeaway here is that many people, including the governor, the state attorney general, have called for investigations or said that they are investigating, but we don't really know what those investigations look like, what their timeframes are, or what kind of actionable outcomes might arise from them. So I'm interested to see what a transparent investigation, internal or external, entails over the course of the next few weeks.
Michelle Liu is a reporter with Mississippi Today. Michelle, thank you again.
Thanks for having me. As your body grows bigger, your mind must flower. It's great to learn, cause knowledge is power. It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block.
On your favorite Schoolhouse Rockin'. And white parents, this one's for you. A quick Google search will find plenty of articles with advice for white parents on how to talk to your kids about race. But while talking is necessary to furthering white kids' understanding of explicit and implicit racism, talking is only part of the solution. White parents' decisions about things like where to raise kids, where to send them to school, extracurriculars, can have profound and complicated effects on the way kids' racial consciousness develops. And sometimes doing the right thing for your own child means doing the wrong thing for everyone else's. That's a tough one for any parent. And it's one of the issues explored by Mississippi State Sociology Professor Margaret Hagerman in the new book, White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. For the book, Professor Hagerman interviewed children and parents, mostly in white upper-middle-class families, to understand how racism is reproduced, often even by those who believe they are living anti-racist lives. Professor Hagerman, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Can you explain the tension that's at the heart of the book between being a good parent and a good citizen?
Sure. So we have this collective sort of agreed upon idea in our society that being a good parent means providing the best opportunities you can for your child. And so for the affluent, white, progressive parents in my research, and I also studied parents that were not, you know, didn't consider themselves to be progressive, but for those parents, this leads to what I talk about in the book as a conundrum. And it's, I call it the conundrum of privilege. And so like you said, on the one hand, you know, these are parents that really believe in racial, you know, equality and fairness and justice and equal opportunity and think of themselves as good citizens. But on the other hand, they are living in a society organized by, you know, race and class. And ultimately, you know, they are giving their children advantages when they make decisions about schools and about extracurriculars and where to live and so forth. And so, you know, they're faced with this decision, this paradox about being a good parent, providing the best for your kids, or being a good citizen and advocating collectively for all of the children in our society.
And this is very relevant in New York right now, as you probably know, with the school segregation conversation here really heating up with the new chancellor who's focused on the issue, as well as similar conversations nationally. And schools, which you just mentioned, that are segregated or somehow perpetuate racial inequality are often also the more prestigious ones and have better resources. So parents might truly, and with the best intentions, be trying to do the right thing for their kids, like saying they prefer integrated settings. But if it's a better school with kids at the same academic level as theirs, not hampered by poverty, let's say, even though we really need to fight poverty too, what do you say to parents with thoughts like those?
Well, I think, you know, based on my research, which was 2 years of spending time with many parents who had that concern, that almost exact same concern, you know, I get what the parents are thinking. And I think that what really is going on is there's a conflict between their abstract value of fairness and their own personal interests of securing the best for their own kid. And so, you know, I think it's, I don't have an easy answer for it, but I think that that tension is ultimately underlying a lot of the, you know, reproduction of inequality through things like school segregation. And, you know, I think like the work of Nicole Hannah Jones, an investigative reporter, you know, she argues that schools are segregated because white people want them that way. And I kind of think that my research also, I do think that my research really supports that claim. And, you know, even with parents that really do care about or say they care about fairness.
When you say, when you come to that conclusion, do you mean that you think there's a lot of white self-described liberal parents out there who
aren't just looking for the kids in their child's classrooms to be sort of at the same academic level, which is often what the language would be, I think. But they really don't want their kids, their white kids, to go to school with black and brown kids per se.
Well, I can only speak to the findings in my study. I can't make any generalizations. But for some of the parents in my study, I mean, they had lots of different reasons why they didn't want their children to go to the public schools in this community that were racially integrated. But these kinds of explanations ranged from things like, well, my kid is too smart, which kind of gets at what you were just saying, but also things like, oh, there's an obesity epidemic. I can't possibly put my child on a bus and send them across town to go to this other school. And so I, you know, after looking at the patterns in my data, I do think that there's a lot there was a lot of evidence of white parents sort of trying to save face and sort of, you know, this veneer of fairness, like, oh, it's fair for, you know, my kid deserves to go to this school for these different reasons. But underlying that, I think, really is something a little bit more troubling.
In your conclusion, you suggest that parents can be good citizens, white parents, only if they reject the idea that their child is innocent. And I think that word comes up a lot in conversations like this, innocent or especially deserving based on individual abilities. So what's left of a parent-child relationship if parents' kids can't be seen as innocent?
So I think, if you read that quote in the context of my book, more holistically, I talk a lot about research that shows that white children are perceived to be more innocent than black children across a number of different arenas. So things like, you know, even in healthcare, black children with acute appendicitis are less likely than white children to receive pain medication in the ER. We know that there's all kinds of racial stereotypes about racist stereotypes about what a gifted student looks like. We know, you know, there's all kinds of evidence from the juvenile justice system about the ways in which black children are racialized. And so when I say that thinking about your child as not just innocent, that's connected to a larger structural arrangement of, you know, a racial hierarchy and the fact that we live in a society that's organized by race. And so when you think that your child's innocent and that the black children in your community are not, you're ultimately reproducing, you know, the very inequality that many, at least the parents in my book, say that they reject. And so, you know, the innocence is tied to our racialized understandings of childhood and which kids get to be seen as innocent and which kids do not.
I think we're going to get a call of pushback here from Jamie in Vernon. Jamie, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. So what this girl is saying is...
Girl, really?
I'm sorry. That's the problem. You're trying to be politically correct. You're supposed to send your kid to a school that may not be the best thing for your school just to be politically correct. Is that what she's saying?
Professor.
Yeah, I have a PhD, so I'm actually a doctor. I think that there's a lot of pushback from parents who think that I'm saying that they should stop caring about their kid and they shouldn't read to their kid and they shouldn't care about their kid. And that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that you can do all of that, but you can also think about other kids. And I don't think that that's that radical of a statement to want to live in a society where we care about other people. I mean, I just don't think that should be that controversial.
Kat in Monmouth County, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kat.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to make the statement that I think that sometimes it's not always a black versus white or a, you know, white people with people of color. I think that sometimes it's socioeconomic issues that are occurring that are, you know, create a concern for parents that are maybe in suburban areas. And I know for myself, working in an urban district, there are a lot of socioeconomic issues that are, you know, cause poverty and things that do affect children's performance in school directly and how they interact with other children in school and all those types of things. And so I think you have to take that into account when you're talking about this, like, what are parents' concerns, not necessarily just because somebody is of a certain race. You know what I mean?
It's not racism.
Professor Hagelman?
Yeah, so of course, you know, we live in a society where there are multiple systems of oppression at play, and they're intersecting in these really powerful ways. So that's, you know, one of the reasons why I chose to study families that experience both economic privilege as well as racial privilege. And so I understand, you know, that you know, it's important. I'm not trying to minimize class in my analysis, but I also think that we can't minimize race. And it's really important to understand that when we don't provide, and my book is actually a lot more about what kids think than just what parents think, but for the sake of this conversation, you know, I just don't think that denying, you know, full citizenship to black kids or brown kids is, you know, part of what we, you know, part of a society that says it's fair and equal and just. And so I just think that parents that have a lot of resources who are making decisions for their kids, you know, should just be mindful and think about how their behaviors might actually be hurting other people.
Lisa, three times.
Hello?
Lisa, you're on.
I'm so sorry. I had trouble hearing you.
That's okay. We have 20 seconds. Go make your point.
Well, I wanted to point out that your speaker corrected everyone saying that she's a doctor, not a professor. So obviously someone's not ignoring class lines. And, you know, I live in a very diverse neighborhood, but does your researcher have children? Because we don't make decisions based on research for our children. We make them on what we think is important for our children. And a lot of that is emotional. And, you know, I think that has to be taken into consideration. Research is research, but real life is something else.
Professor Hagerman, Dr. Hagerman,
I think it's important to say I'm a doctor because I was referred to as a girl. So that was why I did that, that. But certainly this is a really complicated topic. And I think there's a lot of research. And, you know, I'm a researcher, so I'm not a parenting expert. I'm actually not trying to tell parents what to do. I'm trying to offer empirical insights. And what this interview didn't really allow me to do is talk about the children in this book. And I think that I would encourage folks who are very resistant to my message to you know, check out my book and see what the kids say, because I think that that's important. And I think that, you know, oftentimes parents are really focused on what they're doing and how other parents are making decisions. But what is the consequence for the children? How are kids actually developing ideas about race, which is what my book is about? And, you know, that's what I have to offer.
In the last 20 seconds that we can offer, are you surprised at the amount of pushback that you're getting?
Well, you know, I didn't realize that asking people to care about other people was such a controversial point.
Black babies cost less.
Context of white supremacy. Wowee. Labor. Counter-racist labor today. Word of the day is still fair. This is our weekly compensatory call-in, Gus T. Renegade, the Cows. Today's date, Saturday, September 8th, 2018. So I have been told we had technical difficulties that significantly delayed the live start of the program. People that dialed in heard I generally play some sort of counter-racist audio. Depends on, you know, the day, how I feel. Sometimes it'll be 10 minutes before we go live, sometimes 15, but I'll have something playing just because people call in, just so that they know that, you know, we will be ready to roll once it gets time for the live program to begin. We are ready to roll today. And I had uploaded the audio segment with all of the news clips. I had uploaded those hours ago, and I uploaded it. Normally takes, depends on your Wi-Fi speed. It normally takes a few seconds. I'll upload, boop, turn around, you know, I'm doing whatever else. I'll snack on some Brussels sprouts, whatever, playing my yoga class. That's what I did today. I turn back around and I'm thinking, oh, the audio clip is already there. I look, it's not there. I think, oh, maybe I forgot to upload it. I upload, wait a few seconds. I go back. It's not there. This has never happened before where the audio is just not uploading for whatever reason. I tried different browsers, tried different machines. Does not work. In all of the years, decade coming up, broadcasting the Cows, I've not had this problem before where I attempt to upload an audio segment and it just does not happen. So after about 15, 20 minutes of struggle, I was able to get the audio to play in a different manner. I normally have a cord. There have been a few times where, for whatever reason, we had audio difficulties. And I normally have a plug that I use to just set the audio, route the audio differently. But as I am still a displaced, racially dislocated flood victim, I am not at my residence. So I didn't have boop, open up the file cabinet and grab the plug. So it took me a while of stumbling and fumbling, but I think we got it corrected mostly. The audio should be pristine. I think there was a little bit of background noise. I know it was echoing for a while because it took me a while to figure out the controls and what have you, but racist to blame for all of that. Speaking of technical difficulties, and there have been many, a variety of them for the majority of this year, the iTunes upload, there's still an issue for some reason. So about the last 3-4 programs are not there. However, they are available. All of the recent programs, Jasmine Iona Brown, she was here Monday, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, Workplace Racism, all the programs from this past week, and everything else. They're at Black Talk Radio Network. They're also uploaded at SoundCloud. I think there was an issue at Black Talk Radio Network for people that were trying to access the Black Love is a Revolutionary Act study session from yesterday, part two. And that should be available as well, both places. Let me know if you have any problems there. The number for folks to dial if you would like to participate, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to mention before we get started. The Cows, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.com. The address again, racism-notes.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Huge gratitude, appreciation to all the folks who have invested for 9+ years. I hope the context of white supremacy has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you are not interested in PayPal, you can drop me an email and we can get you a physical mailing address. Again, huge thanks to all the folks who have supported and kept us rolling for a decade. I hope we have given out constructive, accurate information on what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. You can also nab items from the wish list at Amazon.com. It's under Gus T. Renegade. My wish list is also linked at my blog, racism-notes.com. A few things before we get to the callers. The word fair was used a number of times in the audio segments that we just heard. Really be mindful of that term when you're talking to people, non-white people. Even a number of Cows listeners dial in and use that word when sharing their views. I have concluded it would be best to not use that term, not to use that term to talk about skin complexion, not to use that word to talk about the weather, certainly not to use that word as a synonym for justice or correct treatment or reasonable thinking, certainly not, and not even as a synonym for white. Not the best word to use, in my view. Other things, the whole segment on Colin Kaepernick, which I definitely did not think was the most important thing that happened this week, not even in the top 10. I thought Nike got a lot of free advertisement, which was touched on in the segment. I think I've been consistent. I think, you know, we've done a decade. Archives are available on some things. Gus T has been remarkably, stubbornly consistent over the last 10 years. And if anything, consistent, you can be consistently incorrect. So hopefully some of the things that have been consistent, they are accurate and logical. One of the things that I have been consistent on, not for 10 years, but at least circa 2016, when all the hubbub about kneeling began, I said from the very beginning, I'm not for Colin Kaepernick, victim of white supremacy. I guess there should be a cowbell there. I am not against him. I am not, never was running rampant. I'm going to get me a number 7 jersey. And that's, you know, my hero. That's, you know, my guy. And I look up to him and I want to never. Like I said, I'm not for him. I'm not against him taking a knee for the anthem. I've seen that before. Many folks do that. That's grand. But it would take, you know, it would take more than that to have me be excited. Like, yeah, that is spectacular. Like, no, that just was never the position that I take. So now we get to Nike saying that he's going to be our pitchman for our apparel. I remember the quote from Minister El-Haj Malik Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, where he said, I'm paraphrasing, he was talking about another victim of white supremacy, as is Colin Kaepernick, but he was talking about another victim of white supremacy getting an award of some sort from whites. And he said that it is confusing, if not suspicious, paraphrasing again, when my enemy, whites, begin giving out awards and trinkets to other black people, particularly they're giving out, he was talking about a peace prize when the war continues. That's pretty much the same logic that I employ. There is no way that I can be pointing at someone and saying, yes, this is my hero for fighting against racism, and suspected racists at Nike point at the same person and say, yes, we will use him to hawk our wares. That just seems very incongruent, illogical at minimum. And again, Mr. Kaepernick, victim of white supremacy, not for it, not against him, just same stance that I've had for the past, what is it, going on 3 years now. Continue. I guess, man, Gus T might be Coon of the Month Club. I was not a Colin Kaepernick fan. I was not a fan of Marvel's Black Panther. I was not a fan of Get Out. And I was not in support of Brother and Sister. Coon of the Month, Gus T. Next, there were a number of Cal's guests that were mentioned, the segment where they were talking about our current president, Mr. Donald J. Trump. Ian Honey Lopez, White by Law, very important book. He was on the program back in 2009. Clarence Lussain, he was on the program in 2010. We talked about several of his Pipe Dream Blues. Very important book. Folks that are doing their research on the so-called opioid epidemic might be interesting to check out Clarence Lussain's work. Said back 2010, we talked about that, all about the white supremacist enforcement of the drug laws, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area in the 1990s and before. Well-researched, really good stuff. But he was mentioned in that segment as well, some of the other things. I'm curious. I don't know if folks got to hear it. It was one of the early sound segments where they were talking about prohibition of hard alcohol at college fraternities. I'm very interested about the enforcement of that statute, exactly, you know, how all of that is going to work. It's been my experience, a lot of these whites do what they want. I have no idea whose job it would be to come in and police the alcohol that they have, or consumption, or however all that works. That I would be very interested to see how all of that unfolds. I think I will pause there. The number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes, whatever commentary you have to share That way everybody gets at least one chance to speak. If you have additional questions or comments, if you could just wait till everyone has spoken at least once, and then you can add your comments or questions, that would be great. If you could please use your mute button if you know you are in an unruly environment, it's college football season, or you're just looking to be rowdy for the last weekend or so of the summertime, grand. Make your comments and then mute your line. That way we don't have to contend or compete with a lot of unnecessary racket. And then you can just mute yourself or unmute yourself if you need to add another comment or question later in the broadcast. Thank you kindly. For this program, for this broadcast, specifically the compensatory call-in, I do request if we could not use metaphors. This is the only broadcast where I make that request. It's been my experience. Racists, they regularly employ metaphors to practice racism, deception. They will contrast, compare, often equate two entities and say, oh yeah, these are exactly alike, twins, identical. And frequently, nothing could be further from the truth. We have been exposed to this racist and deceptive behavior for a long time, myself included. And many of us, we are still learning as such. Often, there are times where we don't have logic to express our views and we will substitute and use a metaphor of some sorts. Frequently, that just creates greater confusion. If we could speak directly, exactly, specifically to what it is that we're talking about, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about metaphors. Actually, is one other thing that I wanted to say. The segment where they were talking about the arrests in small towns, what they said, and that these arrests were happening, little place in Louisiana, these arrests were happening and they were able to detain people, they said, for 72 hours, sometimes longer, without them being charged with anything. It was a black female doing the interview, victim of white supremacy, VGQ, victims guaranteed qualified. But she said it was because of her own biases that she said, oh, it's black people being abused, terrorized by enforcement officials. It must be because of the white power structure. And this is because of my own biases that I thought that. And my thinking is, yes, it is because of the white power structure. That doesn't necessarily mean that there have to be individual white race soldiers who have every nigger knocker, every gun, to go out and pound on, arrest, abuse black people. They can get easily other black people. And 2018, that should not be a surprise. I think there should be enough evidence, enough illustrations of there being police departments where they have a high number of black officers and the black civilians are still being abused and terrorized. I mean, plenty of illustrations of this where this should not be a surprise or new information or people saying that this is somehow evidence that refutes that we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Absolutely not. To me, that evidence would be we have 50% black officers, 50% white officers, and now we've had a sudden skyrocketing number of cases of black officers terrorizing whites and sticking plungers in their rectums and all the rest of it. Then I would start to say, oh, okay, well, wow, maybe we don't have, you know, a system of racism. We're starting to see some of the same thing, but that's not what it is. You just end up with black people, victims of racism, carrying out and doing what racist white supremacist program train direct us to do. Very common, long running. That is the system of white supremacy. With that, no metaphors, 5 minutes, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll get folks who dialed in with a hand up. Again, my apologies for the tech issues. I hope the people who dialed in on the phone line were able to hear the audio okay. I think I listened basically the same way that you all heard it, and I heard it without a problem. I was even going to comment on Donald Trump calling Congresswoman Maxine Waters Maxine, but as we proceed. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Share your thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Rob in California.
Greetings, Gus, and callers and listeners on the line. I didn't get to a report on workplace racism. I am in San Diego. I am employed. I am a dishwasher at a all-you-can-eat Korean barbecue restaurant. And I have never heard so much rap music before in my life. Hip-hop is constantly playing in the restaurant. And whenever someone has a birthday, 50 Cent song, Happy Birthday, is played. So that observation is has been made. The racism that I see, have observed on the job, pretty much Mexicans and black people in the back washing the dishes. Most of the Asians are up front, and most of the Asians that I encounter try to portray themselves as people who are classified as black. That's been the most significant observation that I have seen. And I have noticed the guys kind of watching me almost like an admiration sort of thing. Like, we have a real nigga in the house. And I'm also noticing the females watching me as well. And I've been here for 2 weeks. Next Tuesday will make 3 weeks completely. And I am amazed at the difference and I've been able to make just in my life. The first significant thing that I have been able to do is better treat my health, my ailments. They have something called CBD oil. It's like a topical type of oil. I think it's like a marijuana extract in it, but it's like a, I would describe it as like a extra strength Bengay, and this has worked like amazing. I put it on like before I go to sleep, and I'm like sleeping through the night, and I'm not tossing and turning. And the biggest observation that I have is that things that's needed for health benefits, depending on where you are geographically located within the United States under the system of white supremacy, you may not be able to get the treatment that you need. So I am doing better, and I just wanted to say thank you for all the well wishes and the just the thoughts. People keeping me in their thoughts is greatly appreciated. And the cows specifically, and also the Black Talk Radio Network, has been a form of therapy for me. As we all know, there really is no mental health for black people under this system. And just thank you. And I mute my line.
Glad to hear California is doing well for you thus far, Rob, in San Diego. The resources, we played an audio segment on that a while back. The resources tend to be much more plentiful in geographic locations, states as they are called, with lower numbers of Negroes, like Washington State, Seattle. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? This is Victor out of New Jersey. Two things I just wanted to respond to. The education piece towards the end, and Kaepernick. I would say that the people that I'm surrounded by, I can say that they're more confused than I am. I'm still learning. So it's kind of hard to bring another perspective to the Colin Kaepernick conversation, because a lot of non-whites seen this as a victory. I even seen people saying that, you know, this is a great opportunity to buy stocks and, you know, and, you know, how they were going to go out and purchase more Nikes. If we want to put Colin Kaepernick amongst the ranks of the Muhammad Ali's or even the Malcolm X's, I'm not even saying I do, but let's just say it seems like the corporate wing of white supremacy is skillful in co-opting music. I mean, movement and making them their own. Every January, King Holiday, McDonald's, I Have a Dream speech while selling Big Macs. If you're really not educated on Malcolm X's life and during that time, you would think that Malcolm X joined the Nation of Islam, went to Mecca, found out all white people wasn't bad, was killed by black people. So if you don't go into deeper details or read books like The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X, where I learned that his visit to Mecca, the most important thing about his visit overseas was that he was meeting with other African leaders who was fighting against colonization, and how he was also denied access in many European countries. Education. I don't know if we can, if this ties into that. I was a victim of the education system. Teenage mother, really didn't know, really wasn't real educated in how the education system works. I was funneled in the special education classes, and unfortunately, I was able to fight my way out of there and get into regular classes. It seems that special education is something that, you know, blacks are basically funneled into. So, so that education sequence resonated with me with that there. And how white people, when you bring up the disparities in education, just how that other caller just got so angry, referring to the speaker as girl. She had to produce her credentials and say that she's a doctor. And it does seem like the more blacks that are funded in the education system, you see special education, you see resources diverted from that education district. And that's basically all I have right now, because I don't want to ramble. I have some other things I want to add. I'll wait.
Much obliged. When people say Colin Kaepernick is like Muhammad Ali or any of those, that is a metaphor. If they're putting the like in, then it's a simile. But all of those are metaphors, and that is a great illustration. What does that even mean? What are you talking about? They didn't even play the same sports, totally different eras. Like, what do you mean this person? Nobody is equivalent to another person. Colin Kaepernick is Colin Kaepernick, victim of white supremacy. Muhammad Ali is Muhammad Ali, victim of white supremacy. That right there is saying that this person is this person or this person is like this person. What do you mean? What are you even talking about? That is exactly why I say no metaphors. And something about that metaphor has there's something majorly incorrect about that metaphor. I've always felt that, but that right there, great reminder. No metaphors for this broadcast, specifically compensatory call-in. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Good evening, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
How are you? This is Ngoni speaking, and first and foremost, I would like to ask you to look out for an email from me, from Ngoni Al, for your mailing address. I'd like to contribute. I really appreciate your work. I have really been, for the past month, just listening and listening and listening, and I'm excited because I ordered Neely Fuller's books. I had his original one years ago, but I just got his two new books, and I've been reading those also. So the first comment I have is that about the Kaepernick situation, to me, it's really simple. It really brought home the point that Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. made, that racism and white supremacy is a business. And all the rest of the stuff is just, you know, superfluous, meaningless, you know, racial showcasing, I guess. Would that qualify as racial showcasing as far as you're concerned with Kaepernick?
Could be.
Well, I value your opinion. That's why I asked. I'm new to this, and I'm learning a lot. And the comment I had about the part of the news media talking about the town in Louisiana, I thought it was interesting, and it brought home the point about how you, I think it's justice, you buckets and buckets of words. Because basically, when they were using this term investigative holds, what it really is kidnapping. Real simple. And the other comment I had was about the schools. The lady that was talking about the school situation, it came to my mind that, well, they're closing down public schools all over the country, and with DeVos in there as the, I think she's the Secretary of Education or whatever her title is, and the movement with charter schools. A lot of the news seems, it just seems like it's scripted, and I can see how it seems like its purpose is like for confusion. It was really painful to listen to it. And by the way, and this is my last thing to say, to let you know that I'm sorry you had so much technical difficulties. I literally had to call in four times by phone, and then I went on Facebook and tried to use the HD, and it wouldn't take the number. So I'm glad I got a chance to call in and to listen. Thank you for taking my call.
Wow. I'm sorry you had so much difficulty. I appreciate your persistence in dialing in to share your views. Much appreciated. Hopefully it won't be so difficult if you choose to call in again. Hopefully you'll be able to do it one time. But that right there, that is the system of racism, white supremacy. Expect massive opposition. I could be wrong, but I have the opinion, if we were just calling in to name call other black people, you're Coon, you're Sambo, that sort, if we were just going to do that, I don't think we would have all these tech problems. I think everybody would be able to call in the first time, wouldn't have all these issues. We could Coon it and Sambo it up all night long, and there would not be a problem at all. I could be wrong.
Well, that's why I wanted to let you know that. No apology needed, but I've done a radio show before, and you're absolutely right. I knew that was you were being messed with. I've experienced it myself before.
Much obliged, ma'am. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
May I be heard? You can go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can. Congratulations to Rob. Seems like things are going better for you in San Diego. I hope that keeps up for you. I watched the U.S. Open this course, probably, if you don't know, a lot of controversy. To me, I'm glad I listened to this program because I saw a potential workplace racism and definitely know the policy. Definite know the policy. Otherwise, I'm about to get all my feelings. You know, this is unfair. That was the word they used. So on and so on. Know the policy. And remember that you, as great as you are still a black person. the young lady that was on Monday, Miss Brown, I told you, I think I told my mom about it. We didn't talk that much about it. Well, we talk about racism from time to time when things come up, more so than ever. And, you know, we'll continue to talk about it because I'm her only child and she loves me. So she can't really get around that. And what else did I want to say? Oh, the young lady also, she spoke about watching that Robin DiAngelo lady, how she went to that the seminar in Tacoma. That one happened to be on C-SPAN. I just watched it, I think, at the end of this program, because Saturday night is race night on C-SPAN. They love to talk about race. Like, that's their thing to talk about. And I got something totally different, which is why, as I was listening to her, I knew not to call in, because I don't want to start any debates or things like that, because I heard a different thing. And she was right in the audience, because they showed the one in Tacoma at that church that she was talking about. And I also thought that would be interesting to kind of learn, to listen to, because she didn't take any questions. But for people who are learning, kind of listen to what she's saying and learn to develop questions based on what she said, because I think there were some things that we would see different, not just because she was white, but because they just did not seem logical. So I think C-SPAN, if you want to learn how to practice, listen to a lot of those programs and write down questions, because you never know when that person may be in your area, because a lot of professors go from school to school to school, especially in the larger cities, and give presentations on their books and things like that. So I encourage you to check any college websites. If the person is coming, it will be on their website, and those things are usually free and open to the public, usually in the evening. So if you can go to those and kind of learn and get some practice, if you have the time. I know we have a lot of things to do, but that's something you want to take advantage of. And also, I don't know if we've talked about on the program before, but there's a site called Coursera.org, and it gives free class. You can take free classes from what they call elite professors from Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, especially if you have young people who are going to college. They can learn calculus there on their own pace, so that when they go to college, they take that. I kind of recommend that if you're going to go to college, to take the highest math possible, because you never know when you may go back for an advanced degree, and it's good to have that type of class. And you can just download the material. You can audit the class. Usually auditing is free. So you can just download the materials, and they have things on languages, leadership, time management, a lot of things like that that are free that a lot of people can take advantage of. Thank you.
Spectacular. Sorry about that. Great suggestions about practicing, refining our ability to ask questions. Red in Nevada.
Hello, hello everyone. Thank you for allowing me to share. The first thing, just about some of the segments, I think it's interesting with how there seems to be, I guess, a few victims recently who are kind of being showcased as far as like the Ayanna Pressley segment, where they are winning and they don't like winning elections, whether local or what have you. And they don't really like with that segment, it can almost seem like they really didn't know how she could have done it. But it also makes me curious as to, okay, well, how are they going to use this victim to hurt other Black people? So definitely something to keep in mind. And I'm definitely going to try to at least stay up with some of these different instances where these victims are able to win against the incumbents, especially if these incumbents have millions of dollars. The clip, I think it was about Trump or the Nike clip, whatever clip it was with Huckabee, just ridiculous. He had said something about, we're sick of it, about, I think it was the Nike one. And it's like, well, exactly what are you sick of? And it definitely, it helps me to understand this is how, you know, white people react when they feel like they are being mistreated, and maybe to act accordingly. If we're feeling mistreated, not to necessarily burn the possessions we have if we've already purchased them, but to, you know, white people boycott too. I was looking up the article where it said
even though white people are boycotting, quote unquote, it really didn't hurt Nike. And I think it was actually the Nike segment, but it definitely makes me think about, you know, how white people, and I think how white people react and how they like fire so much. This isn't the first time, sure, not going to be the last time that they like to, that they're burning something or bombing something or whatever, something that makes them upset. And I think it was a white woman in that same Nike segment where she was talking about, or a female was talking about the sweatshops and the deplorable conditions. And it just makes you think about how disgusting some of these white, at least how I feel, how disgusting some of these white women are when they want to be really involved with different causes like the animals, or like if this is a white woman, the sweatshops or whatever, and how the hypocrisy of that individual is talking about, well, look at what they're doing for other people in different areas, the injustice is there, but then they can also ignore the injustices that are happening here. One of the main things is, you know, with the one of the organizations that I really can't stand is PETA, because they do that same thing. The only reason why I feel like I have more interaction with PETA is because I do try to eat healthier. I don't eat any dairy, which has really helped me out overall. And so if anyone wants like any recipes, I usually try to eat like vegan things more often than not. Definitely, Gus has my email. He can always reach out to me. And it's something that has helped me with my health and then also the health of other victims around me. But then back to the other clips, the white woman from the school clip, I felt like I feel like she was maybe kind of wasting her time and wasting other people's time as well, because when that white woman at the end, she had asked the white woman, who again, you know, racist probably, who was asking, well, do you have kids? The doctor, because she had to make sure, Dr. Hagerman had to make sure she was referenced as a doctor. And it made me think about how white people are not ignorant to when they call victims boy and girl, because she really needed to make sure that she needed to separate herself from actually being known as a girl. But she never answered the question about if she had children or not. And then all she basically told that white woman was, well, you know, I only did this, you know, to really make you think, and I'm not really trying to make you take your, you know, give your children like a worse off start in life, but just to at least make you think. Well, why then waste your time if you only are wanting to change people's minds? That doesn't make sense, because you won't have any proof that their minds actually changed. And the last thing about my favorite subject, that was an article, and I've been trying to think about it more along the lines of how can my research on the opioid problem kind of help victims. But there was this article, and now I can't even find it, but it was basically about how this, and I think it was a white woman, didn't really say, but how she was basically complaining about how she couldn't get her pain medication, and the doctor, she had talked to one of the nurses, and the nurse told her when she had some type of leg, I don't know, some type of leg surgery, the nurses was like, oh, well, they're only giving you half as many pain meds that you should get. And how she basically found different ways to not get the opioids, but to get different alternatives. And so, you know, if you know any victims who are suffering from pain, because doctors are not going to give us all the medication, all the information that we need. I know one of the things that was mentioned was tramadol, and you could definitely do your own research about this. And then there are also pain management clinics who don't necessarily give you opioids, but they give you alternatives. And I don't think that's something that doctors will really reference. And I'll try to make sure, if I get any time at the end, I'll try to locate the article and get more information. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Great resources. Red in Nevada, vegan recipes. Love that healthy eating. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Jay in St. Louis.
Hey, I wanted to contribute something to this great show this week. In the last couple of weeks, I've been actually calling in and losing consciousness on the line. So I'm glad I'm still awake. Been just a little sleep deprived. So I wanted to just say right away that I'm going to miss Pam a lot. But focusing on this week's news stories, I wanted to say right away that whites dominate in ambiguity, and the dog whistling that was referred to that is happening from the current president, I think that's a great example of that. And all the other examples that the previous callers have brought up thus far, talking about the different illogical points, especially with the last researcher from Mississippi State who talked about the segregation in the schools and the euphemisms that were used when there was an interview about the incarceration in the small town of in the Louisiana parish. And you're talking about a tenth of the town incarcerated at the same time. Just completely just unfettered barbarism is how I would characterize that on behalf of the state authorities. And supposedly there was supposed to be some kind of contradiction with it being black police officers or black representative officials. But I don't think it is at all. I think your point was right about that. The state, the racial state, can and has been managed by people who we would call black, but I think they approach it in a very simple way, and acting as if the police department is in itself a singular institution, just, you know, on its own devices. It interacts with informal and formal institutions within cities, states, and federal government. So that whole entire thing, I think, was misleading, to say the least. More on the ambiguity, him calling Representative Maxine Waters just Maxine. I think that goes back to some really old playing on the power relationships rich white men have had with black women or and black people generally, just calling them by their first name, being very disrespectful. She's a older woman, so it was just very crass to try to just call her Maxine and refer to her as ugly and make those kind of character judgments. And, you know, I say all of that, but I'm no fan of any politician either. So just wanted to make that point known. And also, see what I could remember from the stories. I also wanted to keep up with that, the things about the schooling, because I mean, this is known. I thought it was important that she mentioned that there were progressives, quote unquote progressive or liberal white parents who were making these decisions to take their children out of these schools and deprive the school system, the public school systems of resources. And I think as non-white students continue to grow and occupy U.S. public schools, there's going to be that's a metaphor. I'll stop myself. There's going to be less lowering enrollments of white students, and it's going to be purposeful. And speaking more to that mystification, when the callers were calling in and the researcher was disrespected, and they kept trying to talk about class and economics or obesity, just complete mystification. All of them know what the issue really is. It's really about race. They're never going to say it. They're never going to come forthright with it. And going back to having a tenth of the entire population, which is, I'm sure, they did say two-thirds black. So a tenth of the population, I mean, that is almost Holocaust levels of incarceration. I think, I actually read Hitler he actually incarcerated 13% of Jewish people in those concentration camps, and that was the highest it had ever gone. So you're talking about an entire tenth of a population just behind bars, and I think a previous caller rightly referred to that as kidnapping, which is what it was, and it's so regular and has been happening for so long. I was almost
I was shocked that the interviewer was surprised. She seemed very surprised that something like that could happen. And I also noticed that the writer kept referring to it as the South. You know, these kind of things happen in the South, or it was all across the South. And I don't like that kind of binary split between the United States, the North and the South. It's all one, you know, anything below Canada is the South. We live in the global South. So that's all I'll say. And I want to thank you for hosting this program. I really appreciate all the archives. And like Robin California or Robin San Diego said, this is therapy for me too, even though I don't always get to participate. I definitely appreciate you for taking the time out to do this.
Much obliged. Just the metaphor that's used, you didn't create it. You were just referencing that's the phrasing that was mentioned in the audio. But dog whistle politics, that is such a fascinating metaphor. I had not thought about it. I don't use that phrase. It is a metaphor. It's not being specific. But the thing that is also important about metaphors is that frequently they reveal more than what was originally intended. Because when you're making these metaphors, you're making associations between ideas, concepts. So a lot of times you get to see how that person is thinking, you know, how they associate things. So dog whistle politics, as I understand the metaphor, it means when whites, they will use words to practice racism, although they have not said anything that is explicitly about white supremacy, racism. That's as I understand it. I think it's fascinating. I never thought of it. Okay, dog whistle, a dog whistle, only dogs can hear it, right? Humans can't hear it. This is supposed to be like the secret dog signal or tune frequency. It's interesting that that's the way that whites, that's the association that would be made, how dogs communicate, how whites communicate. That's, you know, because I don't think a black person came up with that phrasing. I think I could be wrong. It'd be interesting to get the etymology of when that metaphor started being used, dog whistle politics. But that is an interesting comparison because it's comparing whites to dogs and saying that they have a similar way of interpreting a hidden frequency, if that makes sense. I think people have many times made comparison between dogs and whites on the program. That's one of their own offering, I think, right there, the metaphor that is commonly invoked and even accepted. Like, I think you could go and talk to a lot of whites and use that phrase as opposed to saying whites were practicing racism, white supremacy, or being refined. You could say dog whistle politics, and I don't think too many people would get in trouble, and they would probably know what you mean immediately. Very popular, widely used metaphor. Words are important. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if that did not make sense, if it just sounded like Gus was rambling incoherently for about 2 minutes, you can let me know that as well, because we want to make sure that we're being logical and coherent as we proceed. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Is this V in Central New York?
Yes, sir, it is. Good to you, Gus. Hope your evening's going well. Sorry for the technical difficulties earlier. Some major technical difficulties, but I'm glad to be with you tonight, and I also want to say peace to everybody on the line. So I have three topics that I want to broach very quickly, but to the original phrasing, dog whistle. If memory serves me correctly, dog whistle politics came into vogue in the 1980s. It might have originated slightly before then, but I know there was actually a paper that was written by a prominent conservative who stated that conservative Republicans wanted to start speaking about race in this undertone frequency where they could say things that white people understood to be racist, and even black people understood to be racist, but there was plausible deniability behind them. This was also the time when special interests, that phraseology shifted from speaking about corporations and moneyed interests to speaking more about Black people and non-white people specifically. So the Reagan era, if memory serves me correctly, was when these words became more utilized frequently. The three topics, very, very quickly. I am so glad that your show is finally, well, not finally, but it is addressing more loudly the class concept, which has been really hyperly spoken about by progressives, which I'll talk quickly about that in a moment, too. When for Black people, our problem is not class. If we go back to the history of Europe, there was always a class structure, but the unspoken reality was caste, C-A-S-T-E, caste. And they were very deliberate about where you were born in your caste. You did not move from that caste. It didn't matter what level in the class you were in, you still carried that caste with you. The United States is the same way. Color is a caste system. It has been perverted over the years to mean class or to be aligned with class, but it's not. It's really caste. So that's something that we should be cognizant of, and we should really educate ourselves on that, because class is going to become the new dominant way of speaking about race when it is a faulty logic. For progressivism, I have spoken on many occasions with a white person who runs another podcast about how progressivism is nothing more than conservatism with a smiling face. That is a metaphor, yes. But that is how I described it to him. And so Black people don't really get anything from progressivism. The whole concept of progressivism is about 20 years old. It wasn't around technically it's about 100 years old, but it disappeared shortly after it was first created. It wasn't around in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. It really started being kind of talked about in the late 90s. And then in the mid 2000s is when it kind of rose as a dominant theology. But outside of that, it has no primary philosophy. It has no primary structuring, no primary dogma. It is just something that exists. If anybody knows any books that can prove me wrong, please, please send them my way. And then finally, one of the callers talked about treatment centers for opioid addiction and pain addiction. I believe it was pain addiction. And I believe we as Black people, again, need to engage vehemently in developing our project development skills, because we need to be building projects like that in our community as the economy begins to decline more rapidly. What little bit of resources we have access to need to be able to be magnified in our communities. White people are already doing this. They're already doing this. So this is something that we need to be conscious of and cognizant of, because often, as history proves, when things start to get bad economically, they shut us out, which is a metaphor, but they exclude us from what they're doing. And our resources are then very, very scarce and limited. So that's all I wanted to contribute tonight. Thank you very much, Gus. Have a great night.
Much obliged, V. Other folks we've missed completely. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Hi, can I be heard?
Greetings, Draptomania.
Hi, how are you guys and family? The callers. Can you hear me, guys?
I heard that metaphor, family. Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, Gus. I just wanted to give you a call to thank you, and thank you for having a show.
I have noticed in my behavior, I have become less anti-Black in my thinking. And I have had the opportunity, yesterday, to practice some Black self-respect. I was having a conversation with a gentleman on the bus, and we were talking. I didn't know him. And this other gentleman, he was a non-white. I hear echo. Do you hear echo, Gus?
No, ma'am. I do not hear an echo.
Yeah, I hear echo. But anyway, I was talking to the guy on the bus. So the non-Black guy, he got very upset, and he started acting up and cursing at the guy and invited him to fight. So I said nothing. I didn't get excited or anything. And the other guy, he was like talking to him, and it was in front of a bunch of suspects. And I was pretty happy that I didn't get upset. But there's this suspect that had something to say to me, or say had like tried to get involved, and I kind of felt like they were like just sitting back and watching to see how we were going to act up. But you know, I didn't entertain them. So when I got off the bus, he was sitting in on a bus stop, and he said something to me. I guess he was supposed to be drunk. He basically was saying something about this situation that happened on the bus. And what I did, I totally ignored him. I said absolutely nothing. The program, your program, kicked in. About, you know, talking about victims to suspects. And that was one of the first things that popped in my head. And then he started talking all this stuff about Obama, Trump, how he's not racist, and man, I just pay him absolutely no mind. And, so I was pretty happy about that, that I didn't tee into the drama. Because I'm noticing that they just want us to react because they get off on that. I'm sorry, I used a metaphor. They are happy to see us at each other's throats. So I just wanted to thank you and the show and all of the callers, because I am less confused. I grew up in an environment that was very anti-Black. Didn't realize that because I thought I had so much history, knowledge, and knowledge of myself. But I know that I still was very confused. So I look forward to continuing on with my codification and learning not to react and just respond to situations. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Spectacular. Thank you for sharing. That all of us, that was something I was going to say. I think every victim of white supremacy who is present this here evening, September 9, 2018, unfortunately grew up in an environment that was pretty anti-Black. I don't know if we have too many folks who can truthfully say, oh, no, there was no anti-Blackness in my environment. I didn't think so. So you just try to do the best you can, recognizing that and trying to be, you know, more helpful moving forward with your own conduct. And definitely race soldiers, they love instigating conflict. The grandsister, Dr. Welsing, she talked about that frequently, instigating conflict where they just get to have as entertainment, us being in conflict with each other. So excellent, excellent. And that's what it's about, not just listening to this information, but actually implementing these concepts and ideas in our daily, hourly thought, speech, action, and emotions. That's, you know, what the goal is supposed to be. That's why, incidentally, that anti-blackness, that is why we are reading Pam the Great, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, part 3, coming up on Friday. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Might be heard.
Let's see, we'll get Ivy and then Thomas in New York.
Oh, thanks, Thomas in New York, and thanks to Steve Stephen and to all the callers on the line. I wanted to pull up my notes real quick. Thomas, you weren't hearing things the other night on workplace racism. That was me who spoke up. I was a female who spoke up, but I just decided not to say anything because I didn't have anything to report at work, so I didn't want to speak over the people who did. But thank you for trying to yield the floor, and you too, Gus. To Rob, San Diego, I'm so grateful for your update. Thank you for that, and I wish you the best. I hope things continue to improve. Jay in St. Louis, I hope that you get the rest that you need so that you can stop going in and out of consciousness. I hope that you feel better. Great Black self-respect to drop the man. That was awesome. I wanted to say about Colin Kaepernick. He's a victim of racism. I think that he was selected by white people. And I think that that's, very unfortunate. And I think that his kneeling is actually showing respect for the flag. It's not showing disrespect. It's not a protest, in my view. When he was sitting down, that was a protest. And what the white people did is they got another victim to come and convince him to so-called do something more respectful with his kneeling. So now, not only are you, to kneel to a flag or to anything else is more respectful than even standing for it. So now you're doing something even more tributive, for lack of words, to the flag. And that's not something that looks bad. But I think if he would have continued to sit, that they would have killed him or something like that. Like, these white terrorists, they don't play. Or, excuse me, they are very violent. I'll put it that way. His face has been on the cover of a whole lot of magazines. And I just think that he's been selected as our leader. And like Pam the Great said, we should never let our enemy pick our leader. And I think that they tried to have Jesse Williams as our leader as well. And I think another reason, as far as both of them, in terms of what they have in common, is they both have white parents. And I think that they are doing that to control the dialogue around racism. Last thing I just wanted to ask, I noticed that white people, and we talk about this all the time, whenever they see one white person who is less confused, or when they talk as though they are, they get really nervous. And the thing that confuses me about that is that it's just one person. I could be in a room or whatever with, a lot of people who are more confused, and I could be the only one there who's less confused, or it could be someone else where it's just one person. And it's like you have this room full of people who are more confused. Why are you so nervous and asking questions because they're acting different, and you're looking as though, somebody's going to kill you or something? What is it about one person that they seem to have so much power that they can do? Why are you seemingly so afraid of one person? And so I hope that question made sense, and I'll clarify for anyone who needs it, if we have time for someone to answer it. And I'd like that question answered by any of the callers that are willing or who can, and you as well, Gus, if you can. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
For sure. Thomas in New York.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Very good question. I often wonder the same thing. The NFL, National Football League. First thing is the NFL is one of the largest recipients of corporate welfare. They receive money from, just to give a great example, I was just in Vegas. They're building a Raider stadium, and I watched football for, you know, my whole life. The Raiders were my favorite team, and I haven't watched since, you know, for some time since this whole debacle started. But when they're building a Raider stadium on a $2.something billion development altogether, the Raiders only put up $500 million. The rest of that is coming from the city, the state, the county, and the college, the University of Las Vegas, Nevada. All public institutions, all of those things. However, they're putting up the money to build the stadium that this guy's going to own. And he's also telling the people they can't have a public view that work for him, who are mostly people considered Black. So I think that that's wrong. Also, I mentioned this before in one of the shows, the NFL is having an image problem. It's not having an image problem. It's having a marketing problem. We're still trying to market the NFL as the old boy sport, you know, with country music and rock and roll. In contrast to the NBA, it was an article that came out earlier this year that now all of the NBA teams are worth $1 billion, the franchises. Just to put in contrast, when Michael Jordan bought his franchise, it was worth $300 million. Now it's worth over $1 billion because the NBA is marketing using hip-hop and more pop type of thing. So I think they're having more of a marketing problem. And this whole thing with it's just to cover up that they can't figure out how to market their sport to the new generation and appease the white folks from the old generation, just sort of like what that article alluded to. Nike, the world's largest clothing company in revenue. Now, Nike has a contract to make the NFL jerseys. They didn't put that contract on the table to get justice for Colin Kaepernick. They didn't put that contract on the table to get the... To allow the players to be able to not stand up for that flag. However, they're going to give this man a contract now. Most of the players in the NFL who have sneaker endorsements are endorsed by Nike. They're the number one endorser of the players. They didn't get those players not to go out and play and do certain things that they're supposed to do and say they'll cover them while they do that so they can make a political stance. So in my opinion, Nike is just... like that article alluded to, trying to solidify their market base going in the future. Over 50% of the products, of the sneaker products, shoe products that Nike sells are considered premium shoes. Jordans, Air Max, Huaraches, Air Flights, course trainers, things of that nature. Sneakers that cost well over $100 up into the range of $200. 80% of that market base is Black people. 80% of their premium sneaker market is to the Black consumer. It's no way they're going to lose their market selling $200 pair of sneakers that cost them $2 to make to people. They're not going to give that up. So this is just for them to keep their business going. So say, hey, Black people, we're with you. They have leagues all around Harlem for kids to go play basketball. And in none of these leagues do they fix anything in the community. But however, they fix the basketball court in the community very nice every year. At the Rucker, at the Baby Rucker, over in the projects, over along with the King projects, they hook up the courts, but they don't hook up the community the place that they're allowing Black people to live, where these courts are. And for the most part, I'll mute my line for now. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. I'm very grateful for the self-correction because if Black brothers and sisters had a community, they would not need Nike to hook them up with anything, not even a basketball.
other folks that we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. Mr. Fuller is known to suggest to not ask for non-white people not to ask for three things: apology, love, and respect. I'm going to speak on the first one, apology. A clinic example of why not to speak, I mean, why not to ask for an apology, I think was demonstrated by, I don't know her married last name, but I would go by the name that most people in the world know her as, Miss Serena Williams, who I just observed this videotape of her in a, I guess a timeout section. I don't know too much about tennis, but a timeout section of the U.S. Open, I believe it's called. And literally, it was actually was upsetting me because she was very, very upset, very, very serious. Appears to be demanding out of this white male that he is going to apologize to her. And she was so upset that you can literally see veins bulging out of her neck and just was visibly, visibly upset. The white male sitting up in a Welsing, Dr. Welsing moment, as we say, which is a metaphor, but sorry about that. But in a way that Dr. Welsing speaks on, the white male sitting up high in a seat, quote unquote official, calmly, with just letting her talk, and the more she talked, the more upset she got, and she already had been penalized because of the idea that she was being penalized for getting assistance in coaching, and then he calmly penalized her again and accused her, which is a typical tactic of white people, to play the strategy of the victim, accused her of verbal abuse on top of it. In turn, two other officials came on the court. Both of them were white, a white male and white female. And it just looked very, very upsetting to see her just pleading with tears in her eyes about the idea of then she went to gender, not racism, but gender, as a reasoning for her mistreatment. And I say VGQ to that, but nevertheless, she never did mention about racism. And I wouldn't necessarily suggest that she does, but I did hear her talk about gender on the subject. But that was the only thing I had to report. I can report more, but I want on the symbolism that was portrayed by Mr. Kaepernick and all of the different subjects on that level. But basically, that was my observation for the week. When I hear Mr. Fuller constantly talks about not to ask for an apology, love, or respect. And I thought that was a very good example of it. If anyone chooses to see it, you can just see it on YouTube. And it would be more dramatic than how I'm articulating it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Steele.
Yes. Greetings to you, Gus, and the listeners. I wanted to report that I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California, and more specifically Koreatown. I had to say to the caller that recently moved to San Diego, good work on finding yourself in a better situation than the one that you left. Keep striving for better. I've seen plenty of people make the move to Southern California and they wind up in San Diego when they intended to get to Los Angeles or something, and they find themselves in a mode of activity that they find to be somewhat comfortable. However, they're in a situation where they can find themselves stuck, spending more time getting to and from their job and working a job that may not be paying a wage that allows you the freedom, the resources to further improve your life and your station from where you are. So just beware. I've seen plenty of people make the move out here, get very comfortable in a very low station, and find themselves spending all of their time maintaining that low position that they found themselves in. So keep striving for more. Keep striving for better. There's plenty of opportunity here in Southern California to grow and to make more money. And keep pushing. And good luck. I really do like to hear that you landed on your or that you've found yourself in a better position, health-wise and financially as well. So that's good. There was that report earlier where they had the researcher talking to the parent or talking to the listeners of NPR about how they should essentially have more Black people in their schools. And I have to say that I was very impressed with the racist or the suspected white supremacist that called in. They showed a very high level of racist codification. And I think that victims of racism ought to pay attention to when racists are displaying their self-defense tactics. To be truthful, I don't think that there's any benefit that any racist would get from not practicing racism. And these racists, I think, would agree with that sentiment. And anything that gets in the way of their practice of racism, they will fight against. The first caller started by calling her a girl, started by, you know, discrediting her authority and her position and her credentials. And then the female caller followed it up by asking the question, should we disadvantage our children to satisfy the research? And then another caller called in and said, you know, should we to something to the effect of, should we disadvantage our children to practice what they call political correctness? And I think that in listening to that, it should be abundantly clear to any victim of racism that these people will not change their behavior, and these people find their behavior to be correct, and these people find their behavior to be self-defense for their children. And the only time you can deal, and the only way that you can deal with a threat that sees correct behavior as an existential threat to their existence, is, in my estimation, a complete neutralization. And until we get focused on how to neutralize these racists and how to effectively deal with people who view us as an existential threat, I don't think that this will stop. And I think that we are the only people who can stop them. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Other folks that we have missed completely, other folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had a few observations from the audio segment. And the first is from the, it looks like it was the radio segment where all of the callers were calling up. And I think it definitely was a lot of refined white supremacist aggression being utilized through language. And the one lady that was saying that there's something about suburban families, and I worked in a urban district, and there's just concerns about obesity and using every word possible instead of talking about racism. So it was very skillful on that part of not just one caller, but at least, or it was two or three of them, that you have to continuously try to deflect from truthfully admitting what the real problem is. And the segment about Trump, or President Trump or whatever, he was making all of the tweets, and they did the data study or the research on how many times he tweeted about a black person or something. And he either tweeted about black people or individuals who are classified as black. But I'm thinking how he didn't really have a response for Eminem or any other kind of person who wasn't engaged in political office. But he had something to say about LeBron James. So you can just tell that there's even more white supremacy being practiced. And as far as the Colin Kaepernick situation, they were constantly trying to use the term millennials. And that's one term that I find suspicious as well, because I guess that's generally referring to people of a certain age. But as Gus, as you play the multitude of clips from these college campuses, that shows that these so-called millennials, I guess, they still practice racism too. So they can't just confine it to older white men and then say it's about minorities and millennials, and they didn't really define what they mean by millennials, like what time millennials. So it was very interesting, the use of language. And one last thing was the word, I think burn was used, about burning the Nike shoes. And I think that was one guy who said, I'm burning my Nike shoes because Nike had burned something. So that could be definitely another word where you're darkening something and you're talking about racism. So that was an interesting word that was used as well. And that's all I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Incidentally, them burning their shoes, that reminded me of Michael Bradley, Iceman Inheritance. Guest on the program. Something seems very Neanderthal-like about that. Like, gotta go and spark a fire. I'm angry, and yes, we'll go and set a fire, and that will somehow be a soothing or calm my rage. It seems that whites engage in that rather frequently. Iceman Inheritance, Michael Bradley, in the archives. Other folks we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Mhandisi, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I was going to make mention about while I was in college, I was in a psychology class, and you know, I was a lot older, so I've been in college for a number of years, but I was in a psychology class with a lot of younger people, and I had taken that time to do a little experiment, and so I was doing fine in the psychology class because it was a lower level of psychology class, and, you know, I'm familiar with a lot of the subject, and I noticed a lot of the black students, of course, they were making low grades. And some of the students were very beautiful black women. Well, anyway, I decided that we would get a class together or a study session together. And so we went to the library, went to other places, but we went to the library and we would open our books and we would all read. And I would read, and the other people who decided they wanted to read, they would read from the textbook. And the students went from D's and F's to A's and B's, literally. D's and F's to A's and B's. And I only was with black students. But I want to do something similar where I'm reading textbooks, but I keep running into, as I'm looking at the laws, there's laws against books that are not in the public domain as far as reproducing the work. I know Brooke Gustin, you do a lot of the reading program on this show. Maybe you knew of some way around this law of the public domain, how I can actually read these books and possibly record it, or if I can't record it, do you know of any of the rules to clarify that?
It depends on the material. I know if it's for educational purposes, if it's not being sold, that a lot of times they can give leeway depending on what the material is and all of that. It's going to depend on what the text is, you know?
Yes. I'm not even sure like what website or how I would go about finding which text I'm allowed to reproduce without making it a profitable endeavor, you know? But yeah, that was it. Thank you.
I will see if I can help out if listeners, or I guess also if you know a few of the books that you'd like to have an idea about, and then I'll also encourage folks. Yeah, but if you have info, websites, resources that would be of benefit with regards to, and you're trying to read, yes, that's what it sounds like. You're trying to do some sort of audio narration of the text, yes?
Yes, sir. Yes, okay. Sir. Textbooks,
okay. If folks have any resources that would be helpful, and he said textbooks specifically, so textbooks, narrating textbooks, you can drop me an email, I can forward along, and that sort of thing. UntilJustice@gmail.com. Did we miss any callers? Any folks that we've not heard from at all have commentary they wanted to share? Nabbed everybody? Spectacular. To answer Ivy's question about why whites seem so concerned about one non-white person who might be a little less confused than other non-white people, even if it's a substantial number of other non-white people in the area who seem to be very confused about racism, white supremacy, and are not conducting themselves in a codified manner. I think that represents or strongly suggests that you might not need every single non-white person to understand racism, white supremacy to solve this problem. And again, we've had many folks who have said, maybe this problem cannot be solved. Maybe this problem will take 10,000 years to solve. Maybe this problem will take 50,000 years to solve. We've had that come up many times over the decade of our broadcasting. I have concluded, and this is what I've said consistently, because I've seen the same thing, where sometimes I was that only black person in a room full of a whole lot of other non-white people who were very confused, and it seemed to attract a lot of attention, cause a lot of alarm, just one non-white person who was a little bit less confused, asking questions, being suspicious, trying as best he can to follow logic. I think that to me, again, it strongly suggests this problem can be solved and probably much quicker than we think. And again, most importantly, it will not require every single non-white person to endorse the Cows or Dr. Welsing or Dr. Ani or any other non-white person. It will not even require them to be aware of counter-racism. You might not need very many non-white people at all. I suspect we don't have enough right now, but I don't think we'll need every single non-white person that when Mr. Fuller talks about a critical mass, that number might not be as high as we think. That's what it means to me, that one person can have a huge impact. Just one person following logic can have a huge impact on what is happening in a given environment. I think that's what it suggests to me. This problem can be solved. Other folks have anything they need to share before we...
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yes, I just wanted to give a follow-up to a story that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a little girl in Cincinnati who was stung by a cop. I want to make a correction first. She wasn't shoplifting school supplies. She was shoplifting snacks. So more evidence came out because they released the footage of her being tased by the police officers. This one cop officer, Race Soldier Kevin Brown, he was caught on the tape saying, you know, sweetheart, this is why there's no grocery stores in the black community. That's what he told the little girl after he tased her, as he was handcuffing her. And she had her 9-year-old little sister with her. And that was all I wanted to add. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
This is Ngoni. I wanted to just add one more piece to the Kaepernick and Nike situation and ask if you were aware of what happened 2 weeks ago in South Africa in Cape Town concerning Nike.
No, ma'am.
They had to shut down their stores because there was a suspect who proved himself to be a racist who made a video, put it up on YouTube. He was on the beach. And he said he was so happy that there were no Kaffirs anywhere in sight. Kaffir is the same as an N-word in, you know, in our culture or, you know, this side of the. So the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters, you've heard of Malema, South Africa?
Yes.
Okay. Well, they got busy and they... made a big deal out of that. And so I think it's interesting that, you know, 2 weeks later we hear about this deal with Kaepernick, which was protesting against police violence against, non-white people. And then they have this incident in South Africa with the Kaffir statement. So I don't know. To me, it may seem like there might be some connection, and if not, it certainly shows the global nature of the system that Neely Fuller teaches us about, that's for sure. There were other incidents too recently where in China this doesn't have anything to do with Nike, but it's just like there's been several high profile incidents where non-white people have stood up against and exposed racist, violent behavior. Are you familiar with the issue in China where within a 50-mile radius, they refuse service of people from Uganda, Kenya, and one other African country? Even a high-profile government official was refused service. And then there was an incident where a guy from Arizona was in Uganda, and he literally attacked, he was attacking the hotel attendants, and he was explicitly racist in his commentary. You obey me. You're not human. He called them the N-word, and that was put all over the internet. So, you know, maybe as you were saying that maybe it won't take 1,000 years or 10,000 years for us to solve this problem. If we stay on code, I guess, because it is our responsibility to solve the problem, right?
cosmic assignment. That is the way Dr. Welsing phrased it. I'll check to see if other folks have a comment. Incidentally, I would say with the Kaepernick situation, as I understand it, they have commercials that have been filmed with him as their spokesperson and all of that. Those sort of things tend to be decisions that are made months in advance, generally speaking. That's not the type of thing that this sort of decision, and I think he got like a long-term deal with all this. Generally, that's the sort of thing where they plan this out, you know, could have been a year in advance, but certainly I would think they had this planned well in advance and timed this for the beginning of the NFL season. That's generally the way that the more refined, strategic race soldiers operate. Any other folks have comments that they wanted to?
Can I be heard?
Retired. The female caller, was that Ivy?
No, it was Red.
Oh yes, ma'am.
It's okay. The retired firefighter, he can go. I don't know if he spoke yet or not.
He did.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll be quick. I promise. What I was speaking about before about the article, it's on CNN.com. It was actually this woman had cancer and talking about how, you know, she couldn't get enough pain medication during the recovery. She said 15 pills would only get her through a couple of days, but yet she's not an addict. I actually chuckled about that. But the main thing was that she was speaking about how her resources, how her friends were able to tell her about tramadol, which is a non-opioid type of drug. It's TRAMADOL, and there are pain management clinics that provide different resources other than giving you some addictive medication. And that's, again, for victims if they, you know, wanted to check into that. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Yes, I was just going to also state that it's not going to have to take as long as the system of racist white supremacy was established, maintained, expanded, and refined. It's not going to take that long for it to be dismantled and replaced with a system of justice. And it's not going to take every non-white victim of racist white supremacy to accomplish that. I just wanted to ask a brief question. Have anybody heard anything about the Ford Motor Company also giving Mr. Kaepernick a job?
I've not seen.
Okay, maybe on Mr. Clark's Facebook, which is very, very popular, that they may have been kind of like somebody may have been joking about that, because they were also stating that, well, if that's the case, if the white people who are burning their sneakers, they're not going to be burning the F-150s, that's for sure. And I'll leave it at that.
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
Thanks, Gus. Thanks so much. I know we're out of time. Thank you, Gus, so much for your answer. It was brilliant. Thank you, Thomas in New York, for your answer last week. That was brilliant. And I hope everybody on this line has as great a weekend as they can have under conditions of white supremacy. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. I do not see, I think that sort of thing, if you said Ford, the motor company, if they had signed him to any sort of deal, or endorsement or anything, sent him, you know, a bouquet of flowers for his birthday or anything else, I think that would have been big news. And I don't see anything where he's got some sort of deal or contract, or even where they gave him a free tank of gas. So, yeah.
It may have been a spot of humor, because people were commenting back that, well, I'm pretty sure in close proximity to, you know, of white people burning their sneakers, they're not going to be burning their F-150s, which I figure everybody knows that that's a very, very popular pickup truck, and a lot of white people own F-150s.
Get in one more comment. Do we have a last comment anyone needed to get in before we conclude?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry about that. I didn't mean to speak over you, Gus. This is V from New York again. Very quickly, to the question that was asked about one person, one non-white black person being what they today are referring to as conscious around other non-white black people who may not be conscious per se. I know in the current environment which I work, there are not many black people, and they are very, very, very limited on how many black people they seem to allow on each shift. But when a young black male started working on the shift right before mine, the first couple of days he came in, he was wearing kind of, you know, regular street attire. But my father and mother were both from the South, and my father, who was about 16 years older than my mother, grew up in a community in New Orleans, which they didn't wear jeans after, like, when you were 20, unless you were working in the mines. So I never saw my father in jeans. He always wore khakis, a t-shirt, and a button-up shirt, and I emulate that. So going to work, that's how I always dress. This young man, who I maybe said hi to a couple of times, I took notice of the fact that after about that third day, I never saw him again without a shirt with a collar. And then he started wearing khakis, and that was with little communication. So white people are not dumb. They know the concept of alpha male and alpha females, if we want to call them that, and the radical kind of transference of motion, which we do without really communicating. They are very, very keen to that. And so they have to ensure that we are squabbling with each other instead of in good communication or good vibrations with each other. Thank you very much. And have a good night, everybody.
Much obliged. V in New York, that will conclude the broadcast. Robust thanks for all of the listeners, live listeners, patience. If you're listening to the archives, then, you know, not really an issue. But for the live listeners, much obliged for your patience. That was quite irregular, the audio not uploading at all, but we're able to get through it as best we could. We'll be back in the middle of the week. You can check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook for updates. Again, the archive for Black Talk or for Black Love is A Revolutionary Act, the second book study session from yesterday evening. It's in the archives at Black Talk Radio Network and SoundCloud, all that. Just recheck if you had any issues listening. With that, much obliged for everyone who tuned in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I'll get my yoga story in as we conclude. My timing was thrown off. We were late started, so I'll get my yoga commentary as we wrap things up. Went to POC yoga. That's what it's called, people of color yoga. I've been to three of these classes where whites are excluded, and it's non-whites. That's the way the class is advertised. I've been to three of them. They've all been whack. Not do them again. I guess the second one wasn't exactly whack. I didn't participate, but it wasn't something where I was like, oh yeah, this is the greatest thing ever. I've got to do this again. Like, just for whatever reason, like, one, it was more I think the first time I went, it was mostly non-white, non-black people. And then the one that I went to most recently this past week, they had an individual that I thought was white. I began to query and ask other victims who were present, including my pal that I did teacher training with, black female. I asked her, and she said, I think that that is a non-white person, which happened before, happened in teacher training. That time, I was more confident that she was correct because I had an asterisk next to this individual. I thought, meh. Maybe I could be an error, could be white. Maybe we'll have to ask this to see. But this time I did not have that sense at all. I asked other non-whites. All the other non-white people I asked, except my homie from teacher training, thought, oh yeah, I think this is a white person who is practicing racism by being present in this environment. And I've said for all of these events that I've gone to,
this area, there are so many white identified victims that I don't see the value in us going, having this space to do yoga or anything else for that matter, where the whites are basically like just waiting at home on the couch for us or waiting in the car for us or whatever it is. Cause like most of these people have white friends or whatever it is. So I just don't see the value of that. I just don't see the value of that. And then I'm not on the whole brother and sister thing either. I'm not on all of that either. Just has not been an enjoyable experience. I think I would only do it if I were going to be the instructor. But yeah, has not been cool. I'd much rather just go back and perform, do my yoga, typical environment, and be on guard against the race soldiers as opposed to the POC yoga classes. Maybe I just haven't gone to the correct ones. Maybe that's it. I don't think I need to do any more here in Seattle. Perhaps if I were to venture out into another environment, might be noticeably different. We'll have to compare and contrast. We'll call it a broadcast. Much obliged for folks tuning in. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing, Dr. Kanban, I'm pretty sure Dr. Ani, many of the folks that we, Minister Malcolm X, many of the folks that we revere, they would strongly endorse, let's be sober, take great care of our health so that we can respond with logic, crank out a permanent solution to the problem, whites. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every single time we are behind or in a vehicle, whether we are driving or passengers. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.